Shallan and Adolin negotiated with him on the other side of the room, Pattern looming over Shallan's shoulder and making the fortune-teller nervous. Raino had food and supplies for trade, though it would cost them infused spheres. Apparently, Stormlight was the only commodity that mattered on this side.
"Charlatans like him aren't uncommon where I come from,"
Azure said, resting with her back against the wall near Kaladin.
"People who claim to be able to see the future, living off people's hopes. Your society was right to forbid them. The Sprendu likewise, so his kind have to live off in places like this, hoping people will be desperate enough to come to them. Probably get some business with each ship that comes through."
"I saw something, Azure," Kaladin said, still trembling. "It was real."
His limbs felt drained, like the after-effect of lifting weights for a long period.
"Maybe," Azure said. "Those types use dusts and powders that grant euphoria, making you think you've seen something. Even the gods of my land catch only glimpses of the spiritual realm, and in all my life, I've only met one human I believe truly understood it, and he might actually be a god. I'm not sure."
"Wit," Kaladin said. "The man that brought you the medal that protected your soulcaster." She nodded.
Well, Kaladin had seen something. "Dalinar." Adolin walked over and handed Kaladin a squat metal cylinder. He used a device, provided by the Shin Man, to break open the top. There were some fish rations inside. Kaladin poked the chunks with his finger, then inspected the container.
"Canned food," Azure noted. "It's extremely convenient."
Kaladin's stomach rumbled, so he dug into the fish with the spoon Adolin provided. The meat tasted salty, but was good, far better than something soul-cast. Shallan joined them, trailed by Pattern, while the lighthouse keeper bustled off to fetch some supplies they'd traded for. The man glanced at the doorway where the spren of Adolin's blade stood, silent like a statue. Out through the room's window, Kaladin could see Syl standing on the coast, watching out over the sea of beads.
"Her hair doesn't ripple here," he thought.
In the physical realm, it often waved as if being brushed by an unseen breeze. Here, it acted like the hair of a human. She hadn't wanted to enter the lighthouse for some reason. What was that about?
"The lighthouse keeper says a ship will be arriving any time now," Adolin said. "We should be able to buy passage."
Pattern said. "The ship is going to Celebrant. A city on the island."
"Island?"
"It's a lake on our side," Adolin said, "called the Sea of Spears in the southeast of Alethkar, by the ruins of Rathalas."
He drew his lips to a line and glanced away.
"What?"
Kaladin asked.
"Rathalas was where my mother was killed," Adolin said, "assassinated by rebels. Her death drove my father into a fury. We almost lost him to the despair."
He shook his head and Shallan rested her hand on his arm.
"It's not a pleasant event to think about. Sadeas burned the city to the ground in retribution. My father gets a strange, distant expression whenever someone mentions Rathalas. I think he blames himself for not stopping Sadeas, even though he was mad with grief at the time, wounded and incoherent from an attempt on his own life."
"Well, there's still a Spren city on this side," Azure said, "but it's in the wrong direction. We need to be heading west, toward the Horneater Peaks, not south."
Pattern said. "Celebrant is a prominent city. In it we could find passage wherever we wish to go. And the lighthouse keeper doesn't know when a ship going the right way might pass here."
Kaladin put his fish down, then gestured at Shallan.
"Can I have some paper?"
She let him have a sheet from her sketch pad. With an unpracticed hand, he drew out the buildings he'd seen in his momentary whatever it had been.
"I've seen this pattern before, from above." "That's Thalen City," Shallan said, "isn't it?"
That's right, Kaladin thought. He'd only visited once, opening the city's oath gate.
"I saw this in the vision I explained to you."
He glanced at Azure, who seemed skeptical. Kaladin could still feel his emotion from the vision, that thrumming sense of anxiety, the sure knowledge that Dalinar was in grave danger. 9 shadows, a champion who would lead the enemy forces.
"The Oath Gate in Thalen City is open and working," Kaladin said. "Shallan and I saw to that. And since the Oath Gate in Kolinar brought us to Shadesmar, theoretically another, one that isn't corrupted by the Unmade, could get us back."
"Assuming I can figure out how to work it on this side," Shallan said. "That's a pretty daunting assumption."
"We should try to reach the perpendicularity in the peaks," Azure said. "It's the only sure way back."
"The lighthouse keeper says he thinks something strange is happening there," Shallan said. "Ships from that direction have never ended up arriving."
Kaladin rested his fingers on the sketch he'd done. He needed to get to Thalen City. It didn't matter how. The darkness inside him seemed to retreat. He had a purpose, a goal, something to focus on other than the people he'd lost in Kolinar. Protect Dalinar. Kaladin returned to eating his fish, and the group settled in to wait for the ship. It took a few hours, during which the clouds steadily faded in color before growing plain white again. On the other side, the high storm had completed its passing. Eventually, Kaladin saw something out on the horizon, beyond where Syl sat on the rocks. Yes, that was a ship, sailing in from the west. Except, it didn't have a sail. Had he even felt wind in Shadesmar? He didn't think so. The ship crashed through the ocean of beads, surging toward the lighthouse. It employed no sail, no mast, and no oars. Instead, it was pulled from the front by an elaborate rigging attached to a group of incredible spren. Long and sinuous, they had triangular heads and floated on multiple sets of rippling wings. Storms! They pulled the ship like chulls. Flying, majestic chulls with undulating bodies. He'd never seen anything like it. Adolin grunted from where he stood by the window.
"Well, at least we'll be traveling in style."
98. Loopholes.
Lore suggested leaving a city if the Spren there start acting strangely. Curiously, Ja'anat was often regarded as an individual, when others, like Moalak or Ashurtmarn, were seen as forces.
From Hesse's Mythica, page 90.
Zeth O'Shinovar left the Skybreaker Fortress with the 20 other squires. The sun approached the clouded horizon to the west, gilding the Pure Lake red and gold. Those calm waters, strangely, now sprouted dozens of long wooden poles. Of various heights, ranging from 5 to 30 feet, these poles appeared to have been jammed into fissures in the lake bottom. Each had an odd knobby shape at the top.
"This is a test of martial competence," Master Warren said.
The Azish man looked strange in the garb of a Marabetian lawkeeper, chest bare and shoulders draped with the short, patterned cloak. The Azish were normally so proper, overly encumbered with robes and hats.
"We must train to fight, if the desolation truly has begun."
Without Nin's guidance to confirm, they spoke of the desolation in ifs and mights.
"Each pole is topped with a group of bags bearing powders of a different color," Warren continued. "Fight by throwing those, you cannot use other weapons, and you cannot leave the contest area marked by the poles. I will call time over when the sun sets. We will tally the number of times each squire's uniform was marked by one of the bags of powder. You lose 4 points for each different color on your uniform, and an additional point for each repeated hit from a color. The winner is the one who has lost the fewest points. Begin."
Zeth drew in Stormlight and lashed himself into the air with the others. Though he didn't care if he won arbitrary tests of competence, the chance to dance the lashings, for once without needing to cause death and destruction, called to him. This would be like those days in his youth, spent training with the Honor Blades. He soared upward about 30 feet, then used a half-lashing to hover. Yes, the tops of the poles each bore a collection of small pouches tied on by strings. He lashed himself past one, snatching a pouch, which let out a puff of pink dust as it came off in his hand. He now saw why the squires had been told to wear a white shirt and trousers today.
"Excellent," Zeth said, as the other squires scattered, grabbing pouches.
"What?"
the sword asked. Zeth carried it on his back, tied securely in place at an angle from which he could not draw the weapon.
"I don't understand. Where is the evil?"
"No evil today, Sword Nimi. Just a challenge."
He hurled the pouch at one of the other squires, hitting her square in the shoulder, and the resulting dust colored her shirt in that spot. Notably, the master had said that only color on the uniform would be counted, so holding the pouches and dusting one's own fingers was fine. Similarly, hitting each other in the face gained no advantage. The others took quickly to the game. Soon pouches were being flung in all directions. Each pole bore only a single color, encouraging competitors to move about to hit others with as many colors as possible. Jorrit tried hovering in one spot anyway, dominating one pole to prevent others from hitting him with its color. Sitting still made him a target, however, and his uniform was quickly covered in spots. Zeth dove, then pulled himself up with an expert lashing so that he swooped, skimming the surface of the Pure Lake. He grabbed a pole as he passed, bending it out of Callie's reach as she went by above.
"I'm down too low," Zeth realized as bags of dust fell toward him. "Too easy a target."
He twisted back and forth, executing a complex maneuver that manipulated both lashings and the wind of his passing. Pouches smacked the water near him. He pulled upward. Lashing wasn't like the flight of a swallow. Instead, it was like tying oneself to strings, a puppet to be yanked about. It was easy to lose control, as evidenced by the awkward motions of the newer squires. As Zeth gained height, Zedzil fell in behind him, holding a pouch in each hand. Zeth added a second lashing, upward, then a third. His stormlight lasted so much longer than it had before. He could only assume that radiants were more efficient than those who used honor blades for the powers. He shot upward like an arrow, wind spren joining and twisting around him. Zedzil followed, but when he tried to throw a pouch at Zeth, the wind was too great. The pouch fell backward immediately, striking Zedzil on his own shoulder. Zeth dropped into a dive, and Zedzil followed until Zeth snatched a green bag from a pole and tossed it over his shoulder, hitting Zedzil again. The younger man cursed, then shot away to find easier prey. Still, this combat proved to be a surprising challenge. Zeth had rarely fought in the air itself, and this contest felt similar to when he'd battled the Windrunner in the skies. He twisted among the poles, dodging pouches, even snatching one from the air before it hit him, and found he was enjoying himself. The screams from the shadows seemed dim, less pressing. He wove between thrown pouches, dancing above a lake painted by the hues of a setting sun, and smiled. Then immediately felt guilty. He had left tears, blood, and terror in his wake like a personal seal. He had destroyed monarchies, families, innocent and guilty alike. He could not be happy. He was only a tool of retribution, not redemption, for he dared not believe in such. If he was to be forced to keep living, it should not be a life that anyone would ever envy.
"You think like Vasher," the sword said in his head. "Do you know Vasher? He teaches swords to people now, which is funny because Varatrelides always says Vasher isn't any good with the sword."
Zeth rededicated himself to the fight, not for joy, but for practicality. Unfortunately, his momentary distraction earned him his first hit. A dark blue pouch struck, its circle stark on his white shirt. He growled, soaring upward with a pouch in each hand. He flung them with precision, hitting one squire in the back, then another in the leg. Nearby, four of the older squires flew in formation. They would chase an isolated squire, swarming him or her with a flurry of eight pouches, often scoring six or seven hits, while rarely getting hit themselves. As Zeth zoomed past, they fixated on him, perhaps because his uniform was nearly pristine. He immediately lashed himself upward, canceling his lateral lashing, to try to get above the pack. These were well practiced with their powers, however, and not so easily put off.
If he continued straight upward, they'd merely chase him until he ran out of stormlight. Already his reserves were low, as each squire had only been given enough to last through the contest. If he double or triple lashed himself too often, he'd run out early. The sun was slipping inch by inch out of sight. Not much time left. He simply needed to last. Zeth dove to the side, moving quickly and erratically. Only one of the pack chasing him chanced a throw. The others knew to wait for a better shot. Zeth's swoop took him straight toward a pole, but it held no pouches. Fari looked like he had gathered them all up to hoard the color, so Zeth grabbed the pole itself. He pushed it to the side, bending it until it snapped, leaving him with a pole some 10 feet long. He lightened it with a partial lashing upward, then tucked it under his arm. A quick glance over the shoulder showed that the four teammates were still tailing him. The one who had thrown earlier had grabbed two new pouches and was catching up to the others with a double lashing.
"Make a stand," the sword suggested. "You can take them."
For once, Zeth agreed. He zoomed down until he was near the water, his passing causing a trail of ripples on the surface. Younger squires dodged out of his way, flinging dust bags but missing because of his speed. He deliberately lashed himself to the side in a smooth, predictable turn. It was exactly the opportunity the pack had been waiting for, and they started throwing at him. But he was no frightened child to be intimidated and overwhelmed by superior numbers. He was the assassin in white, and this was but a game. Zeth spun and began batting the pouches away with his staff. He even managed to hit the last one back into the face of the leader of the group, a man named Ty. It wouldn't count as a mark, but the dust got in Ty's eyes, causing him to blink and slow. The group expended most of their pouches, which let Zeth, lashed now directly toward them, get close. And nobody should ever let him get too close. He dropped his staff and grabbed a squire by her shirt, using her as a shield from an opportunist outside the group who was throwing crimson bags. Zeth spun with her, then kicked her toward a companion. They slammed together, trailing streaks of red dust. He grabbed another squire from the pack, trying to lash him away. The man's body resisted the lashing, however. People bearing stormlight were more difficult to lash, something Zeth was only now coming to understand. He could, however, lash himself backward, hauling the man with him. When he let go, the squire had trouble adjusting to the change in momentum and jolted in the air, letting himself get hit by a half-dozen bags from outsiders. Zeth zipped away, running dangerously low on stormlight. Only another few minutes. Beneath him, Ty called to the others, pointing up at Zeth, the obvious current winner. Only one strategy made sense at this point.
"Get him!"
Ty shouted.
"Oh, good,"
the sword said. Zeth lashed himself downward, which proved wise as many of the squires shot up past him, assuming he'd try to stay high. No, his best defense, while outnumbered, was confusion. He got among them, a storm of pouches targeting him. Zeth did what he could to avoid them, zipping one way, then the other, but there were too many attacks. The poorly aimed ones were the most dangerous, as moving out of the way of a well-placed attack almost always took him into the path of an errant one. One pouch struck his back, followed by a second. A third hit his side. Dust flew all around as the squires hit each other, too. That was his hope, that even as he took hits, they would take more. He soared up, then dove again, causing the others to dodge like sparrows before a hawk. He flew along the water, scattering fish in the waning light, then shot upward to... His stormlight ran out. His glow vanished. The tempest within died. Before the sun could set, the cold took him. Zeth arced in the air and was pummeled with a dozen different pouches. He dropped through the cloud of multicolored dust, leaving an afterimage from his loosely fastened spirit. He splashed into the Pure Lake. Fortunately, he hadn't been too high, so the landing was only mildly painful. He hit the bottom of the shallow lake. Then, when he stood up, the others hit him with another round of pouches. No mercy from this group. The last sliver of sun vanished, and Master Warren shouted an end to the test. The others streaked away, their stormlight conspicuous in the dimming light. Zeth stood waist-deep in water.
"Wow," the sword said. "I kind of feel bad for you."
Thank you, Sword Nimi. What were those two spren floating nearby, shaped as small slits in the air? They separated the sky like wounds in skin, exposing a black field full of stars. When they moved, the substance of reality bent around them. Zeth bowed his head. He no longer ascribed to spren any particular religious significance, but he could still be in awe of these. He might have lost this contest, but he seemed to have impressed the high spren. Or had he lost? What exactly had the rules been? Thoughtful, he ducked under the water, swimming in the shallow lake back towards the bank. He climbed out, water streaming from his clothing as he walked up to the others. The masters had brought out bright sphere lanterns along with food and refreshment. A Tashiki squire was recording the points while two masters adjudicated what counted as a hit and what did not. Zeth suddenly felt frustrated by their games. Nin had promised him the opportunity to cleanse Shinovar. What time was there for games? The moment had come for him to ascend to a rank beyond all of this. He walked up to the masters.
I am sorry to have won this contest, as I did the last one with the prison.
You,
Ty said, incredulous. Ty had 5 spots on him. Not bad.
You got hit at least 2 dozen times.
I believe, Zeth replied, that the rules stated the winner was the one with the fewest marks on his uniform.
He held his hands to the side, showing his white clothing washed clean during his swim. Warren and Key shared a look. She nodded with a hint of a smile.
There is always one, Warren said, who notices that. Remember that while loopholes are to be exploited, Zeth San Nutoro, they are dangerous to rely upon. Still, you have done well, both in your performance and in seeing this hole in the rules.
He glanced into the night, squinting at the 2 highspren who seemed to have made themselves visible to Warren as well.
Others agree.
He used a weapon,
one of the older squires said, pointing.
He broke the rules.
I used a pole to block pouches, Zeth said, but I did not attack anyone with it.
You attacked me,
said the woman he'd thrown at someone else.
Physical contact was not forbidden, and I cannot help if you are unable to control your lashings when I release you.
The masters didn't object. Indeed, Key leaned in to Warren.
He is beyond the skill of these. I hadn't realized.
Warren looked back to him.
You shall soon have your spren, gauging by this performance.
Not soon, Zeth said. Right now. I shall say the 3rd ideal this night, choosing to follow the law.
No,
a voice interrupted. A figure stood up on the low wall surrounding the Order's stone courtyard. Skybreakers gasped, holding up lanterns, illuminating a man with dark makabaki skin, highlighted by a white crescent birthmark on his right cheek. Unlike the others, he wore a striking uniform of silver and black. Nin Sun God, Nail, Naku, Nalan. This man had 100 different names and was revered across all Roshar. The Illuminator. The Judge. A founder of humankind, defender against the desolations, a man ascended to divinity. The Herald of Justice had returned.
Before you swear, Zeth San Nutoro, Nin said, there are things you need to understand.
He looked across the skybreakers.
Things you all must understand. Squires, masters, gather our gemstone reserves and mobile packs. We will leave most of the squires. They leak stormlight too much, and we have a long way to go.
Tonight, just one,
Key asked.
Tonight. It is time for you to learn the 2 greatest secrets I know.
Shallan's sketchbook. Mandras. They appear to come in a variety of sizes. They move with a sinuous grace, but unlike sky eels, I don't know if the mandras really need to obey any rules of physics. The wings move in a regular rhythm, but they do not appear to be the source of either locomotion or lift. The shape of the head is exactly the same as the Lux Bren that can be found accompanying great shells. I am sure it's no coincidence that they're the same as those that fly beside sky eels. The process by which the sailors steer is incredible to watch. Each mandra is harnessed with a rig of pulleys on each side. To steer in the desired direction, the pulleys' ropes are shortened on the corresponding side and then retied to the cleats on the ship's railing.
99. Reachers. Ner-Gaul was known for driving forces into a battle rage, lending them great ferocity. Curiously, he did this to both sides of a conflict, Voidbringer and human. This seems common of the less self-aware Spren. From Hesse's Mythica, page 121. When Kaladin awoke on the ship in Shadesmar, the others were already up. He sat, bleary-eyed, on his bunk, listening to beads crash outside the hull. There almost seemed a pattern or rhythm to them, or was he imagining things? He shook his head, standing and stretching. He had slept fitfully, slumber interrupted by thoughts of his men dying, of Elokar and Moash, of worries for Drahi and Scar. The darkness blanketed his feelings, making him lethargic. He hated that he was the last to rise. That was always a bad sign. He used the facilities, then forced himself to climb up the steps. The vessel had three levels. The bottom was the hold. The next level, the lower deck, was for the cabins where the humans had been given a spot for them all to share. The uppermost deck was open to the sky, and was populated by Spren. Sill said they were light Spren, but the common name was Reachers. They looked like humans with strange bronze skin, metallic, as if they were living statues. Both men and women wore rugged jackets and trousers, actual human clothing, not merely imitations of it like Sill wore. They didn't carry weapons other than knives, but the ship had wicked harpoons clipped in racks at the sides of the deck. Seeing those made Kaladin infinitely more comfortable. He knew exactly where to go for a weapon. Sill stood near the bow, watching out over the sea of beads again. He almost missed spotting her at first because her dress was red instead of its normal white-blue. Her hair had changed to black and her skin was flesh-colored, tan, like Kaladin's. What on Roshar? He crossed the deck toward her, stumbling as the ship crashed through a swell in the beads. Storms! And Shallan said this was more smooth than some boats she'd been on? Several Reachers passed, calmly managing the large riggings and harnesses that attached to the Spren who pulled the craft. "Ah, human," one of the Reachers said as Kaladin passed. That was the captain, wasn't it? Captain Eco? He resembled a Shin man with large, childlike eyes made of metal. He was shorter than the Alethi, but sturdy. He wore the same tan clothing as the others, sporting a multitude of buttoned pockets. "Come with me," Eco told Kaladin, then crossed the deck without waiting for a response. They didn't speak much, these Reachers. Kaladin sighed, then followed the captain back to the stairwell. A line of copper plating ran down the inside wall of the stairwell, and Kaladin had seen a similar ornamentation on the deck. He'd assumed it was decorative, but as the captain walked, he rested his fingers on the metal in an odd way. Touching a plate with the tips of his fingers, Kaladin felt a distinct vibration. They passed the quarters of the ordinary Spren sailors. They didn't sleep, but they did seem to enjoy their breaks from work, swinging quietly in hammocks, often reading. It didn't bother him to see male Reachers with books. Spren were obviously similar to Ardents, who were outside of common understandings of male and female. At the same time, Spren? Reading? How odd. When they reached the hold, the captain turned on a small oil lamp. So far as Kaladin could tell, he didn't use a flaming brand to create the fire. How did it work? It seemed foolhardy to use fire for light with so much wood and cloth around.
Why not use spheres for light? Kaladin asked him.
We have none, Iko said. Stormlight fades too quickly on this side.
That was true. Kaladin's team carried several larger unset gemstones, which would hold stormlight for weeks. But the smaller spheres would run out after a week or so without seeing a storm. They'd been able to trade the chips and marks to the lighthouse keeper in exchange for barter supplies, mostly cloth, to buy passage on this ship.
The lighthouse keeper wanted the stormlight, Kaladin said. He kept it in some kind of globe.
Captain Iko grunted.
Foreign technology, he said. Dangerous. Draws the wrong spren.
He shook his head.
At Celebrant, the money changers have perfect gemstones that can hold the light indefinitely. Similar.
Perfect gemstones? Like the Stone of 10 Dawns?
I don't know of this thing. Light in a perfect stone doesn't run out, so you can give stormlight to the money changers. They use devices to transfer it from smaller gemstones to their perfect ones. Then they give you credit to spend in the city.
The hold was closely packed with barrels and boxes that were lashed to the walls and floor. Kaladin could barely squeeze through. Iko selected a rope-handled box from a stack, then asked Kaladin to pull it out as Iko resettled the boxes that had been atop it, then relashed them. Kaladin spent the time thinking about perfect gemstones. Did such a thing exist on his side? If there really were flawless stones that could hold stormlight without ever running out, that seemed important to know. It could mean the difference between life and death for Radiance during the Weeping. Once Iko was done resettling the cargo, he gestured for Kaladin to help him pick up the box they'd removed. They maneuvered it out of the hold and up onto the top deck. Here, the captain knelt and opened the box, which revealed a strange device that looked a little like a coat rack, although only about 3 feet tall. Made entirely of steel, it had dozens of small metal prongs extending from it, like the branches of a tree. Only it had a metal basin at the very bottom. Iko fished in a pocket and took out a small box from which he removed a handful of glass beads like those that made up the ocean. He placed one of them into a hole in the center of the device, then waved toward Kaladin.
Stormlight.
For what?
For you to live.
Are you threatening me, Captain?
Iko sighed and regarded him with a suffering expression, very human in its nature. It seemed the look of a man talking to a child. The Spren captain waved his hand, insistent, so Kaladin took a diamond mark from his pocket. Cradling the sphere in one hand, Iko touched the glass bead he'd put in the fabrial.
This is a soul, he said. Soul of water, but very cold.
Ice?
Ice, from a high, high place, he said. Ice that has never melted. Ice that has never known warmth.
The light in Kaladin's sphere dimmed as Iko concentrated.
You know how to manifest souls?
No,
Kaladin said.
Some of your kind do, he said. It is rare. Rare among us, too. The gardeners among the cultivation spren are best at it. I am unpracticed.
The ocean bead expanded and grew cloudy, looking like ice. Kaladin got a distinct sense of coldness from it. Iko handed back the diamond mark, now partially drained, then dusted off his hands and stood up, pleased.
What does it do? Kaladin asked.
Iko nudged the device with his foot.
It gets cold now.
Why?
Cold makes water, he said. Water collects in that basin. You drink and don't die.
Cold makes water?
It didn't seem to be making any water that Kaladin could see. Iko hiked off to survey the spren steering the ship, so Kaladin knelt beside the device, trying to understand. Eventually, he spotted drops of water collecting on the branches of the device. They ran down the metal and gathered in the basin.
Huh.
When the captain had said, during their initial negotiations, that he could provide water for human passengers, Kaladin had assumed the ship would have some barrels in the hold. The device took about a half hour to make a small cup of water, which Kaladin drank as a test. The basin had a spigot and a detachable tin cup. The water was cool, but flavorless, unlike rainwater. How did coldness make water, though? Was this melting ice in the physical realm somehow and bringing it here? As he was sipping the water, Syl walked over, her skin, hair, and dress still colored like those of a human. She stopped next to him, placed her hands on her hips, and went into full pout.
What? Kaladin asked.
They won't let me ride one of the flying Spren.
Smart.
Insufferable.
Why on Roshar would you look at one of those things and think, you know what, I need to get on its back? Syl looked at him as if he were crazy.
Because they can fly.
So can you. Actually, so can I.
You don't fly. You fall the wrong way.
She unfolded her arms so that she could fold them immediately again and huff loudly.
You're telling me you're not even curious what it's like to climb on one of those things?
Horses are bad enough. I'm not about to get onto something that doesn't even have legs.
Where's your sense of adventure?
I dragged it out back and clubbed it senseless for getting me into the army. What have you done to your skin and hair, by the way?
It's a light weaving, she said. I asked Shallan because I didn't want rumors of an honor spren spreading from the ship's crew.
We can't waste stormlight on something like that, Syl.
We used a mark that was running out anyway, she said. So it was worthless to us. It would have been depleted by the time we arrived. So it's wasting nothing.
What if there's an emergency? She stuck her tongue out at him, then at the sailors at the front of the ship. Kaladin returned the little tin cup to its place on the side of the device, then settled with his back to the ship railing. Shallan sat across the deck near the flying spren, doing sketches.
You should go talk to her,
Syl said, sitting next to him.
About wasting stormlight? Kaladin said.
Yes, perhaps I should. She does seem inclined to be frivolous with who she expends it for. Syl rolled her eyes.
What?
Don't go lecture her, silly. Chat with her. About life. About fun things.
Syl nudged him with her foot.
I know you want to. I can feel that you do. Be glad I'm the wrong kind of spren, or I would probably be licking your forehead or something to get at your emotions.
The ship surged against a wave of beads, the souls of things in the physical world.
Shallan is betrothed to Adolin, Kaladin said. Which isn't an oath,
Syl said.
It's a promise to maybe make an oath sometime.
It's still not the sort of thing you play around with. Syl rested her hand on his knee.
Kaladin, I'm your spren. It's my duty to make sure that you're not alone.
Is that so? Who decided?
I did. And don't give me excuses about not being lonely or about only needing your brothers in arms. You can't lie to me. You feel dark, sad. You need something, someone, and she makes you feel better.
Storms. It felt like Syl and his emotions were double-teaming him. One smiled with encouragement while the other whispered terrible things. That he'd always be alone, that Tara had been right to leave him. He filled another cup with as much water as he could get from the basin, then carried it toward Shallan. The pitching of the ship almost made him dump the cup overboard. Shallan glanced up as he eased down beside her, his back resting against the deck's railing. He handed her the cup.
It makes water, he said, thumbing at the device, by getting cold.
Condensation. How fast does it go? Nivani would be interested in that.
She sipped the water, holding it in her gloved, safe hand, which was strange to see on her. Even when they'd traveled the bottoms of the chasms together, she'd worn a very formal hava.
You walk like they do,
she said absently, finishing her sketch of one of the flying beasts.
They?
The sailors. You keep your balance well. You'd have been at home as a sailor yourself, I suspect.
Unlike some others. She nodded toward Azure, who stood across the deck holding onto the railing for dear life and occasionally shooting distrusting glares at the Reachers. Either she did not like being on a ship, or she did not trust the Spren. Perhaps both. "May I?" Kaladin asked, nodding toward Shallan's sketch. She shrugged, so he took the sketchpad and studied her pictures of the flying beasts. As always, they were excellent.
"What does the text say?"
"Just some theorizing," she said, flipping back a page in her notebook. "I lost my original of this picture, so this is kind of crude. But have you ever seen something like these arrowhead Spren here?" "Yeah," Kaladin said, studying her drawing of a sky eel flying with arrowhead Spren moving around it. "I've seen them near great shells. Chasm fiends, sky eels, anything else that should be heavier than it actually is. Sailors call them luck Spren on our side." She gestured with the cup toward the front of the ship where sailors managed the flying beasts. "They call these mandras, but the arrowhead shapes on their heads are the same shape as luck Spren. These are bigger, but I think they, or something like them, help sky eels fly."
"Chasm fiends don't fly."
"They kind of do, mathematically. Vavimar did the calculations on Reshi great shells and found they should be crushed by their own weight."
"Huh,"
Kaladin said. She started to get excited. "There's more. Those mandras, they vanish sometimes. Their keepers call it dropping. I think they must be getting pulled into the physical realm. It means you can never use only one mandra to pull a ship, no matter how small that ship. And you can't take them, or most other Spren, too far from human population centers on our side. They waste away and die for reasons people here don't understand."
"Huh. So what do they eat?"
"I'm not sure," Shallan said. "Syl and Pattern talk about feeding off emotions, but there's something else that..." She trailed off as Kaladin flipped to the next page in her notebook. It seemed like an attempt at drawing Captain Eco, but was incredibly juvenile. Basically just a stick figure.
"Did Adolin get a hold of your sketchbook?" he asked.
She snatched the book from him and closed it. "I was just trying out a different style. Thanks for the water." "Yes, I had to walk all the way from over there. At least 7 steps. "Easily 10, Shallan said. "And on that precarious deck, very dangerous. Practically as bad as fighting the fused. Could have stubbed your toe, or gotten a splinter, or pitched over the side and been lost to the depths, buried by 1,000,000 beads in the weight of the souls of an infinite number of forgotten objects. Or that?" "Highly unlikely," Shallan agreed. "They keep this deck well maintained, so there really aren't any splinters. With my luck, I'd find one anyway." "I had a splinter once," Shallan noted. "It eventually got out of hand."
You did not just say that."
"Yes, you obviously imagined it. What a sick, sick mind you have, Kaladin."
Kaladin sighed, then nodded to the sailors.
"They do walk about barefoot. Have you noticed that? Something about the copper lines set into the deck."
"The copper vibrates," Shallan said, "and they keep touching it. I think they might be using it to communicate somehow."
"That would explain why they don't talk much," Kaladin said. "I'd have expected them to watch us a little more than they do. They don't seem that curious about us."
"Which is odd, considering how interesting Azure is."
"Wait, just Azure?"
"Yes. In that polished breastplate and striking figure, with her talk of chasing bounties and traveling worlds, she's deeply mysterious."
"I'm mysterious," Kaladin said.
"I used to think you were. Then I found out you don't like good puns. It's truly possible to know too much about somebody."
He grunted. "I'll try to be more mysterious. Take up bounty hunting." His stomach growled. "Starting with a bounty on lunch, maybe." They'd been promised 2 meals a day, but considering how long it had taken Eco to remember they needed water, perhaps he should ask.
"I've been trying to track our speed," Shallan said, flipping through her notebook.
She went quickly through the pages, and he could see that, oddly, they alternated between expert renditions and comically bad ones. She landed on a map she'd made of this region in Shadesmar. Alethi rivers were now peninsulas, and the Sea of Spears was an island, with the city named Celebrant on the western side. The river peninsulas meant that in order to get to the city, the ship had to swing to the west. Shallan had marked their path with a line.
It's hard to gauge our progress, but I'd guess that we're moving faster than the average ship in our world. We can go directly where we want without worrying about the winds, for one thing.
So, 2 more days? Kaladin asked, guessing based on her marks.
More or less. Quick progress.
He moved his fingers down toward the bottom of her map.
Thalen City?
He asked, tapping one point she'd marked.
Yes. On this side it will be on the edge of a lake of beads. We can guess the Oathgate will reflect there as a platform like the one we left in Kolinar. But how to activate it?
I want to try. Dalinar is in danger. We need to get to him, Shallan. In Thalen City. She glanced at Azure, who maintained that was the wrong direction to go.
Kaladin, I don't know if we can trust what you saw. It's dangerous to presume you know the future.
I didn't see the future, Kaladin said quickly. It wasn't like that. It was like soaring the sky with the Stormfather. I know
I have to get to Dalinar.
She still seemed skeptical. Perhaps he'd told them too much of the Lighthouse Keeper's theatrics.
We'll see once we get to Celebrant.
Shallan closed her map, then squirmed, glancing back at the railing they'd been leaning against.
Do you suppose they have chairs anywhere? These railings aren't very comfortable for sitting against.
Probably not.
What do you even call these things?
Shallan said, tapping the railing.
A deck wall?
No doubt they've made up some obscure nautical word, Kaladin said. Everything on a ship has odd names. Port and starboard instead of left and right. Galley instead of kitchen. Nuisance instead of Shallan.
There was a name. Railing? Deck guard? No, whale. It's called a whale.
She grinned.
I don't really like how it feels to sit against this whale, but I'm sure I'll eventually get over it.
He groaned softly.
Really? Vengeance for calling me names.
Name. One name. And it was more a declaration of fact than an attack. She punched him lightly in the arm.
It's good to see you smiling.
That was smiling?
It was the Kaladin equivalent. That scowl was almost jovial.
She smiled at him. Something felt warm within him at being near her. Something felt right. It wasn't like with Laurel, his boyhood crush, or even like with Tara, his first real romance. It was something different, and he couldn't define it. He only knew he didn't want it to stop. It pushed back the darkness.
Down in the chasms, he said, when we were trapped together, you talked about your life, about your father. I remember, she said softly, in the darkness of the storm. How do you do it, Shallan? How do you keep smiling and laughing? How do you keep from fixating on the terrible things that have happened? I cover them up. I have this uncanny ability to hide away anything I don't want to think about. It's getting harder, but for most things I can just...
She trailed off, staring straight ahead.
There. Gone.
Wow.
I know, she whispered. I'm crazy. No. No, Shallan. I wish I could do the same.
She looked at him, brow wrinkling.
You're crazy.
How nice it would be if I could simply shove it all away.
Storms.
He tried to imagine it, not spending his life worrying about the mistakes he'd made, not hearing the constant whispers that he wasn't good enough, or that he'd failed his men.
This way I'll never face it, Shallan said.
It's better than being unable to function.
That's what I tell myself.
She shook her head.
Yasna said that power is an illusion of perception. Act like you have authority, and you often will. But pretending fragments me. I'm too good at pretending.
Well, whatever you're doing, it's obviously working. If I could smother these emotions, I'd do so eagerly.
She nodded, but fell silent, then resisted all further attempts to draw her into conversation. 100. An Old Friend. I am convinced that Ner'Gaul is still active on Roshar. The accounts of the Alethi thrill of battle align too well with ancient records, including the visions of red mist and dying creatures. From Hesse's Mythica, page 140. Dalinar remembered almost everything now. Though he still hadn't recovered the details of his meeting with the Night Watcher, the rest was as fresh as a new wound, dripping blood down his face. There had been so many more holes in his mind than he'd realized. The Night Watcher had ripped apart his memories like the fabric of an old blanket, then sewn a new quilt out of it. In the intervening years, he'd thought himself mostly whole, but now all those scars had been ripped free and he could see the truth. He tried to put all of that out of his mind as he toured Vadenar, one of the great cities of the world, known for its amazing gardens and lush atmosphere. Unfortunately, the city had been devastated by the Vaden Civil War, then the subsequent arrival of the Everstorm. Even along the sanitized path he walked for the tour, they passed scorched buildings, piles of rubble. He couldn't help but think of what he'd done to Rathalas, and so Evie's tears accompanied him. The cries of dying children. Hypocrite, they said. Murderer. Destroyer. The air smelled of salt and was filled with the sounds of waves smashing on cliffs outside the city. How did they live with that constant roaring? Did they never know peace? Dalinar tried to listen politely as Taravangian's people led him into a garden full of low walls overgrown with vines and shrubs. One of few that hadn't been destroyed in the Civil War. The Vadens loved ostentatious greenery, not a subtle people, all brimming with passion and vice. The wife of one of the new Vaden High Princes eventually led Navani off to inspect some paintings. Dalinar was instead led to a small garden square, where some Vaden light eyes were chatting and drinking wine. A low wall on the eastern side here allowed for the growth of all kinds of rare plants in a jumble, which was the current horticultural fashion. Lifespren bobbed among them. More small talk?
Excuse me, Dalinar said, nodding toward a raised gazebo. I'm going to take a moment to survey the city.
One of the light eyes raised his hand.
I can show...
No, thank you, Dalinar said, then started up the steps to the gazebo. Perhaps that had been too abrupt. Well, at least it fit his reputation. His guards had the sense to remain below at the foot of the steps. He reached the top, trying to relax. The gazebo gave him a nice view of the cliffs and the sea beyond. Unfortunately, it let him see the rest of the city. And storms. It was not in good shape. The walls were broken in places, the palace nothing more than rubble. Huge swaths of the city had burned, including many of the plate-like terraces that had been Vaden showpieces. Out beyond, on the fields north of the city, black scars on the rock still showed where heaps of bodies had been burned following the war. He tried to turn away from all that and look out at the peaceful ocean, but he could smell smoke. That wasn't good. In the years following Evie's death, smoke had often sent him descending into one of his worst days. Storms, I'm stronger than this. He could fight it. He wasn't the man he'd been all those years ago. He forced his attention toward the stated purpose of visiting the city, surveying the Vaden martial capabilities. Many of the living Vaden troops were barracked in storm bunkers right inside the city walls. From reports he'd heard earlier, the Civil War had brought incredible losses, even baffling ones. Many armies would break after suffering 10% casualties, but here, reportedly, the Vadens had continued fighting after losing more than half their numbers.
Perhaps they'd been driven mad by the persistent crashing of those waves. And what else did he hear? More phantom weeping. Talon's palms. Dalinar drew a deep breath, but smelled only smoke.
Why must I have these memories?
He thought, angry.
Why did they suddenly return?
Mixing with those emotions was a growing fear for Adolin and Elikar. Why hadn't they sent word? If they'd escaped, wouldn't they have flown to safety? Or at the very least, found a span reed? It seemed ridiculous to assume multiple Radiants and Shardbearers were trapped in the city, unable to flee. But the alternative was to worry that they hadn't survived, that he'd sent them to die. Dalinar tried to stand, straight-backed and at attention beneath the weight of it all. Unfortunately, he knew too well that if you locked your knees and stood too straight, you risked fainting. Why was it that trying to stand tall should make you so much more likely to fall? His guards at the base of the stone hill parted to let Taravangian, in his characteristic orange robes, shuffle through. The old man carried an enormous, diamond-shaped kite shield, large enough to cover his entire left side. He climbed up to the gazebo, then sat down on one of the benches, panting.
"Did you want to see one of these, Dalinar?"
he asked after a moment, holding out the shield. Glad for the distraction, Dalinar took the shield, hefting it.
"Ashard?"
he said, noting a steel box with a gemstone inside fastened to the inner surface.
"Indeed,"
Taravangian said.
"Crude devices. There are legends of metal that can block a shard blade, a metal that falls from the sky. Silver, but somehow lighter. I should like to see that, but for now we can use these."
Dalinar grunted.
"You know how they make fabrials, don't you?"
Taravangian asked.
"Enslaved Spren?"
"Spren can't be enslaved any more than a chul can."
The Stormfather rumbled distantly in his mind.
"That gemstone,"
Taravangian said,
"imprisons the kind of spren that gives things substance, a kind that holds the world together. We have entrapped in that shield something that, at another time, might have blessed a night radiant."
Storms. He couldn't deal with a philosophical problem like this today. He tried to change the topic.
"You seem to be feeling better."
"It's a good day for me. I feel better than I have recently, but that can be dangerous. I'm prone to thinking about mistakes I've made."
Taravangian smiled in his kindly way.
"I try to tell myself that, at the very least, I made the best choice I could with the information I had."
"Unfortunately, I'm certain I didn't make the best choices I could," Dalinar said.
"But you wouldn't change them. If you did, you'd be a different person."
"I did change them," Dalinar thought. "I erased them. And I did become a different person."
Dalinar set the shield beside the old man.
"Tell me, Dalinar,"
Taravangian said.
"You've spoken of your disregard for your ancestor, the Sunmaker. You called him a tyrant."
"Like me."
"Let us say," Taravangian continued, "you could snap your fingers and change history. Would you make it so that the Sunmaker lived longer and accomplished his desire, uniting all of Roshar under a single banner?"
"Turn him into more of a despot," Dalinar said. "That would have meant him slaughtering his way all across Aesir and into Eerie."
"Of course I wouldn't wish that."
"But what if it left you, today, in command of a completely unified people? What if his slaughter let you save Roshar from the Voidbringer invasion?"
"I... he'd be asking me to consign millions of innocents to the pyre."
"Those people are long dead,"
Taravangian whispered.
"What are they to you? Numbers in a scribe's footnote? Yes, the Sunmaker was a monster. However, the current trade routes between Herdaz, Yarkaved, and Aesir were forged by his tyranny. He brought culture and science back to Alethkar, Your modern Alethi cultural eruption can be traced directly back to what he did. Morality and law are built upon the bodies of the slain.
I can't do anything about that.
No, no. Of course you can't.
Terebengian tapped the half-shard shield.
Do you know how we capture Spren for Fabrials, Dalinar? From span reeds to heat reels, it's all the same. You lure the Spren with something it loves. You give it something familiar to draw it in, something it knows deeply. In that moment, it becomes your slave.
I really can't think about this right now.
Excuse me,
Dalinar said.
I need to go check on Navani.
He strode from the gazebo and down the steps, bustling past Ryle and his other guards. They followed, towed in his wake like leaves after a strong gust of wind. He entered the city, but didn't go looking for Navani. Perhaps he could visit the troops. He walked back along the street, trying to ignore the destruction. Even without it, though, the city felt off to him. The architecture was very like Alethi architecture, nothing like the flowery designs of Carbranth or Thelenha. But many buildings had plants draping and dangling from every window. It was strange to walk along streets full of people who looked Alethi but spoke a foreign tongue. Eventually, Dalinar reached the large storm shelters right inside the city walls. Soldiers had set up tent cities next to them, temporary bivouacs they could tear down and carry into one of the loaf-like bunkers for storms. Dalinar found himself growing calmer as he walked among them. This was familiar. This was the peace of soldiers at work. The officers here welcomed him, and generals took him on tours of the bunkers. They were impressed by his ability to speak their language, something he'd gained early in his visit to the city, using his bondsmith abilities. All Dalinar did was nod and ask the occasional question, but somehow he felt like he was accomplishing something. At the end, he entered a breezy tent near the city gates where he met with a group of wounded soldiers. Each had survived when his entire platoon had fallen. Heroes, but not the conventional type. It took being a soldier to understand the heroism of simply being willing to continue after all your friends had died. The last in line was an elderly veteran who wore a clean uniform and a patch for a defunct platoon. His right arm was missing, his jacket sleeve tied off, and a younger soldier led him up to Dalinar.
"Look, Gevid, the Blackthorn himself. Didn't you always say you wanted to meet him?"
The older man had one of those stares that made him seem like he could see right through you.
"Bright Lord," he said, and saluted. "I fought your army at Slick Rock, sir. Bright Lord Nalinar's 2nd Infantry. Storming fine battle that was, sir."
"Storming fine indeed," Dalinar said, saluting him back.
"I figured your forces had us at 3 different points."
"Those were good times, Bright Lord. Good times. Before everything went wrong."
His eyes glazed over.
"What was it like?" Dalinar asked softly. "The Civil War, the battle here at Vadenar." "It was a nightmare, sir."
"Gevid," the younger man said, "let's go. They have food."
"Didn't you hear him?"
Gevid said, pulling his remaining arm out of the boy's grip.
"He asked. Everyone dances around me, ignoring it. Storms, sir. The Civil War was a nightmare."
"Fighting other Vaden families,"
Dalinar said, nodding.
"It wasn't that," Gevid said. "Storms, we squabble as much as you do, sir. Pardon that. But I ain't ever felt bad fighting my own. It's what the Almighty wants, right?"
"But that battle,"
he shuddered.
"Nobody would stop, Bright Lord. Even when it should have been done. They just kept right on fighting. Killing because they felt like killing.
It burned in us,"
another wounded man said from by the food table. The man wore an eye patch and looked like he hadn't shaved since the battle.
"You know it, Bright Lord, don't you? That river inside of you, pulling your blood all up into your head and making you love each swing, making it so that you can't stop, no matter how tired you are.
the thrill. It started to glow inside Dalinar. So familiar, so warm, and so terrible. Dalinar felt it stir like a favorite axe hound, surprised to hear its master's voice after so long. He hadn't felt it in what seemed like an eternity. Even back on the Shattered Plains, when he'd last felt it, it had seemed to be weakening. Suddenly that made sense. It wasn't that he'd been learning to overcome the thrill. Instead, it had left him. To come here. "Did others of you feel this?" Dalinar asked.
"We all did," another of the men said, and Gevid nodded. "The officers, they rode about with teeth clenched and rictus grins. Men shouted to keep the fight, maintain the momentum."
"It's all about momentum." Others agreed, talking about the remarkable haze that had covered the day. Losing any sense of peace he'd gained from the inspections, Dalinar excused himself. His guards raced to keep up as he fled, moving even faster as a newly arrived messenger called to him, saying he was needed back at the gardens. He wasn't ready. He didn't want to face Taravangian or Navani or especially Renarin. Instead, he climbed the city wall. Inspect the fortifications. That was why he'd come. From the top, he could again see those large sections of the city, burned and broken in the war. The thrill called to him, distant and thin. No. No! Dalinar marched along the wall, passing soldiers. To his right, waves crashed against the rocks. Shadows moved in the shallows, beasts two or three times as big as a chull, their shells peeking from the depths between waves. It seemed that Dalinar had been four people in his life. The bloodlusty warrior, who killed wherever he was pointed, and the consequences could go to damnation. The general, who had feigned distinguished civility when secretly he'd longed to get back on the battlefield so he could shed more blood. Third, the broken man, the one who paid for the actions of the youth. Then finally, the fourth man, most false of them all. The man who had given up his memories so he could pretend to be something better. Dalinar stopped, resting one hand on the stones. His guards assembled behind him. A Vaden soldier approached from the other direction along the wall, calling out in anger.
"Who are you? What are you doing up here?"
Dalinar squeezed his eyes shut.
"You, Alethi, answer me! Who let you scale this fortification?"
The thrill stirred, and the animal inside him wanted to lash out. A fight. He needed a fight. No. He fled again, hurrying down a tight, constricting stone stairwell. His breathing echoed against the walls, and he nearly stumbled and tripped down the last flight. He burst out onto the street, sweating, surprising a group of women carrying water. His guards piled out after him.
"Sir?" Ryle asked. "Sir, are you... Is everything..."
Dalinar sucked in stormlight, hoping it would drive away the thrill. It didn't. It seemed to complement the sensation, driving him to act.
"Sir?"
Ryle said, holding out a canteen that smelled of something strong.
"I know you said I shouldn't carry this, but I did. And you might need it."
Dalinar stared at that canteen. A pungent scent rose to envelop him. If he drank that, he could forget the whispers, forget the burned city and what he had done to Rathalos, and to Evie. "So easy.
Blood of my fathers, please. No."
He spun away from Ryle. He needed rest. That was all, just rest. He tried to keep his head up and slow his pace as he marched back toward the Oathgate. The thrill nipped at him from behind. "If you become that first man again, it will stop hurting. In your youth, you did what needed to be done. You were stronger then." He growled, spinning and flinging his cloak to the side, looking for the voice that had spoken those words. His guards shied back, gripping their spears tightly. The beleaguered inhabitants of Vaidnar scurried away from him.
"Is this leadership? To cry each night? To shake and tremble? Those are the actions of a child, not a man."
"Leave me alone,"
Give me your pain. Dalinar looked toward the sky and let out a raw bellow. He charged through the streets, no longer caring what people thought when they saw him. He needed to be away from this city. There, the steps up to the Oath Gate. The people of this city had once made a garden out of its platform, but that had been cleared away. Ignoring the long ramp, Dalinar took the steps two at a time, Stormlight lending him endurance. At the top, he found a cluster of guards in Colin blue standing with Navani and a smattering of scribes. She immediately strode over.
Dalinar? I tried to ward him off, but he was insistent. I don't know what he wants.
He? Dalinar asked, puffing from his near run. Navani gestured toward the scribes. For the first time, Dalinar noticed that several among them wore the short beards of Ardens. But those blue robes? What were those? Curates, he thought, from the Holy Enclave in Valeth. Technically, Dalinar himself was a head of the Vorin religion, but in practice the curates guided church doctrine. The staves they bore were wound with gemstones, more ornate than he'd expected. Hadn't most of that pomp been done away with at the fall of the hierocracy?
Dalinar Colin,
one said, stepping forward. He was young for an Ardentia leader, perhaps in his early 40s. His square beard was streaked with a few lines of gray.
I am he,
Dalinar said, shrugging off Navani's touch to his shoulder.
If you would speak with me, let us retire to a place more private.
Dalinar Colin,
the Arden said louder.
The Council of Curates declares you a heretic. We cannot tolerate your insistence that the Almighty is not God. You are hereby proclaimed excommunicate and anathema.
You have no right.
We have every right. The Ardens must watch the light eyes so that you steer your subjects well. That is still our duty as outlined in the Covenants of Theocracy, witnessed for centuries. Did you really think we would ignore what you've been preaching?
Dalinar gritted his teeth as the stupid Ardent began outlining Dalinar's heresies one by one, demanding that he deny them. The man stepped forward, close enough now that Dalinar could smell his breath. The thrill stirred, sensing a fight, sensing blood.
I'm going to kill him, a part of Dalinar thought. I have to run now, or I will kill this man.
It was as clear to him as the sun's light. So he ran. He dashed to the Oathgate control building, frantic with the need to escape. He scrambled up to the keyhole and only then remembered that he didn't have a shard blade that could operate this device.
Dalinar, the Stormfather rumbled. Something is wrong. Something I cannot see. Something hidden to me. What are you sensing?
I have to get away.
I will not be a sword to you. We spoke of this.
Dalinar growled. He felt something he could touch, something beyond places, the power that bound worlds together. His power.
Wait, the Stormfather said. This is not right.
Dalinar ignored him, reaching beyond and pulling power through. Something bright white manifested in his hand, and he rammed it into the keyhole. The Stormfather groaned, a sound like thunder. The power made the Oathgate work regardless. As his guards called his name outside, Dalinar flipped the dial that would make only the small building transport, not the entire plateau, then pushed the keyhole around the outside of the room using the power as a handhold. A ring of light flashed around the structure and cold wind poured in through the doorways. He stumbled out onto a platform before Urethiru. The Stormfather pulled back from him, not breaking the bond, but withdrawing his favor. The thrill flooded in to replace it. Even this far away. Storms! Dalinar couldn't escape it.
You can't escape yourself, Dalinar, Evie's voice said in his mind. This is who you are. Accept it.
He couldn't run. Storms, he couldn't run. Blood of my fathers, please, please help me.
But to whom was he praying? He staggered down from the platform in a daze, ignoring questions from soldiers and scribes alike. He made his way to his room, increasingly desperate to find a way, any way, to hide from Evie's condemning voice.
In his rooms, he pulled a book off the shelf, bound in hogshide with thick paper. He held the Way of Kings as if it were a talisman that would drive back the pain. It did nothing. Once this book had saved him, but now it seemed useless. He couldn't even read its words. Dropping the book, he stumbled out of the room. No conscious thought led him to Adolin's chambers or drove him to ransack the younger man's room. But he found what he'd hoped, a bottle of wine kept for a special occasion, violet, prepared in its strength. This represented that third man he'd been. Shame, frustration, and days spent in a haze. Terrible times. Times he'd given up part of his soul in order to forget. With storms, it was either this or start killing again. He raised the bottle to his lips. 101. Deadeye.
Moaloch is very similar to Nergaul, though instead of inspiring a battle rage, he supposedly granted visions of the future. In this, lore and theology align. Seeing the future originates with the unmade, and is from the enemy. From Hesse's Mythica, page 143. Adolin tugged at the jacket standing in Captain Eco's cabin. The Spren had lent the room to him for a few hours. The jacket was too short, but was the biggest the Spren had. Adolin had cut off the trousers right below the knees, then tucked the bottoms into his long socks and tall boots. He rolled the sleeves of the jacket up to match, approximating an old style from Thelena. The jacket still looked too baggy. Leave it unbuttoned, he decided. The rolled sleeves look intentional that way. He tucked his shirt in, pulled the belt tight. Good by contrast? He studied it in the captain's mirror. It needed a waistcoat. Those, fortunately, weren't too hard to fake. Eco had provided a burgundy coat that was too small for him. He removed the collar and sleeves, stitched the rough edges under, then slid it up the back. He was just finishing it up, with some laces on the back, when Eco checked in on him. Adolin buttoned on the improvised waistcoat, threw on the jacket, then presented himself with hands at his sides.
"Very nice," Eco said. "You look like an honor spren going to a feast of light."
"Thanks," Adolin said, inspecting himself in the small mirror. "The jacket needs to be longer, but I don't trust myself to let down the hems."
Eco studied him with metal eyes, bronze with holes for the pupils, like Adolin had seen done for some statues. Even the spren's hair appeared sculpted in place. Eco could almost have been a soulcast king from an age long past.
"You were a ruler among your kind, weren't you?" Eco asked. "Why did you leave? The humans we get here are refugees, merchants, or explorers, not kings."
King? Was Adolin a king? Surely his father would decide not to continue with the abdication now that Elokar had passed.
"No answer," Eco said. "That is fine. But you were a ruler among them. I can read it in you. Highborn status is important to humans." "Maybe a little too important, eh?"
Adolin said, adjusting the neck scarf he'd made from his handkerchief.
"That is true," Eco said. "You are all human, and so none of you, regardless of birth, can be trusted with oaths. A contract to travel, that is fine, but humans will betray trust if it is given to them."
The Spren frowned, then seemed to grow embarrassed, glancing away.
"That was rude." "Rudeness doesn't necessarily imply untruth, though. I didn't mean an insult, regardless. You are not to be blamed. Betraying oaths is simply your nature as a human." "You don't know my father," Adolin said.
Still, the conversation left him uncomfortable. Not because of Eco's words, Spren tended to say odd things and Adolin didn't take offense. More, he felt his own growing worry that he might actually have to take the throne. He'd grown up knowing it could happen, but he'd also grown up wishing, desperately, that it never would.
In his quiet moments, he'd assumed this hesitance was because a king couldn't apply himself to things like dueling and, well, enjoying life. What if it went deeper? What if he'd always known inconsistency lurked within him? He couldn't keep pretending he was the man his father wanted him to be. Well, it was moot anyway. Alethkar as a nation had fallen. He accompanied Iko back out of the captain's cabin onto the deck, walking over to Shallan, Kaladin, and Azure, who stood by the starboard whale. Each wore a shirt, trousers, and jacket they'd bought off the Reachers with dun spheres. Dun gemstones weren't worth nearly as much on this side, but apparently trade with the other side did happen, so they had some value. Kaladin gaped at Adolin, looking down at his boots, then up at the neck scarf, then focusing on the waistcoat. That befuddled expression alone made the work worthwhile.
"How?" Kaladin demanded. "Did you sew that?"
Adolin grinned. Kaladin looked like a man trying to wear his childhood suit. He'd never button that coat across his broad chest. Shallan fit her shirt and jacket better from a pure measurements standpoint, but the cut wasn't flattering. Azure looked far more normal without her dramatic breastplate and cloak.
"I'd practically kill for a skirt," Shallan noted. "You're kidding," Azure said. "No. I'm getting tired of the way trousers rub my legs. Adolin, could you sew me a dress? Maybe stitch the legs of these trousers together?"
He rubbed his chin, which had begun to sprout a blonde beard.
"It doesn't work that way. I can't magic more cloth out of nothing. It..."
He trailed off as overhead the clouds suddenly rippled, glowing with a strange mother-of-pearl iridescence. Another high storm. Their second since arriving in Shadesmar. The group stopped and stared up at the dramatic light show. Nearby, the Reachers seemed to stand up more straight, move about their sailing duties more vigorously.
"See," Asher said, "I told you. They must feed off it somehow."
Shallan narrowed her eyes, then grabbed her sketchbook and stalked over to begin interviewing some of the Spren. Kaladin trailed away to join his Spren at the prow of the ship, where she liked to stand. Adolin often noticed him looking southward, as if anxiously wishing the ship to move more quickly. He lingered by the side of the ship, watching the beads crash away below. When he looked up, he found Azure studying him.
"Did you really sew that?" she asked.
"There wasn't much sewing involved," Adolin said. "The scarf and jacket hide most of the damage I did to the waistcoat, which used to be a smaller jacket."
"Still," she said, "an unusual skill for a royal."
"And how many royals have you known?"
"More than some might assume."
Adolin nodded.
"I see. And are you enigmatic on purpose, or is it a kind of accidental thing?"
Asher leaned against the ship's whale, breeze blowing her short hair. She looked more youthful when not wearing the breastplate and cloak. Mid-30s, maybe.
"A little of both. I discovered when I was younger that being too open with strangers went poorly for me. But in answer to your question, I have known royals, including one woman who left it behind. Throne, family, responsibilities."
"She abandoned her duty?" That was practically inconceivable.
"The throne was better served by someone who enjoyed sitting on it."
"Duty isn't about what you enjoy. It's about what is demanded of you in serving the greater good. You can't just abandon responsibility because you feel like it." Asher glanced at Adolin, and he felt himself blush.
"Sorry," he said, looking away. "My father and my uncle might have instilled me with a little passion on the topic."
"It's all right," Asher said. "Maybe you're right. And maybe there's something in me that knows it. I always find myself in situations like in Kolinar, leading the wall guard. I get too involved, then abandon everyone."
"You didn't abandon the wall guard, Azure," Adolin said. "You couldn't have prevented what happened."
"Perhaps.
I can't help feeling that this is merely one in a long string of duties abdicated, of burdens set down, perhaps to disastrous results. For some reason, she put her hand on the pommel of her shard blade when she said that. Then she looked up at Adolin. But of all the things I've walked away from, the one I don't regret is allowing someone else to rule. Sometimes the best way to do your duty is to let someone else, or someone more capable, try carrying it. Such a foreign idea. Sometimes you took up a duty that wasn't yours, but abandoning one? Just giving it to someone else? He found himself musing on that. He nodded his thanks to Azure as she excused herself to get something to drink. He was still standing there when Shallan returned from interviewing, well, interrogating, the Reachers. She took his arm, and together they watched the shimmering clouds for a while.
"I look terrible, don't I?" she finally asked, nudging him in the side. "No makeup, with hair that hasn't been washed in days, and now wearing a dumpy set of workers' clothing?"
"I don't think you're capable of looking terrible," he said, pulling her closer. "In all their color, even those clouds can't compete."
They passed through a sea of floating candle flames, which represented a village on the human side. The flames were huddled together in patches, hiding from the storm. Eventually, the clouds faded, but they were supposedly near the city now, so Shallan got excited, watching for it. Finally, she pointed to land on the horizon. Celebrant nestled not far down its coast. As they drew closer, they spotted other ships entering or leaving the port, each pulled by at least two Mandras. Captain Eco walked over.
"We'll soon arrive. Let's go get your Deadeye."
Adolin nodded, patting Shallan on the back, and followed Eco down to the brig, a small room far aft in the cargo hold. Eco used keys to unlock the door, revealing the spren of Adolin's sword sitting on a bench inside. She looked at him with those haunting, scratched-out eyes, her string face void of emotion.
"I wish you hadn't locked her in here," Adolin said, stooping down to peer through the squat doorway.
"Can't have them on deck," Eco said. "They don't watch where they're walking and fall off. I'm not going to spend days trying to fish out a lost Deadeye." She moved to join Adolin, then Eco reached over to shut the cell.
"Wait," Adolin said. "Eco, I saw something moving back there."
Eco locked the door and hung the keys on his belt.
"My father."
"Your father?" Adolin said.
"You keep your father locked up?"
"Can't stand the thought of him wandering around somewhere," Eco said, eyes forward. "Have to keep him locked away, though. He'll go searching for the human carrying his corpse, otherwise. Walk right off the deck."
"Your father was a Radiant Spren?"
Eco started toward the steps up to the deck.
"It is rude to ask about such ones. Rudeness doesn't imply untruth, though, right?"
Eco turned and regarded him, then smiled wanly and nodded toward Adolin's Spren.
"What is she to you?"
"A friend.
A tool. You use her corpse on the other side, don't you? Well, I won't blame you. I've heard stories of what they can do, and I am a pragmatic person. Just don't pretend she is your friend."
By the time they reached the deck, the ship was approaching the docks. Eco started calling orders, though his crew clearly knew what to do already. The Celebrant docks were wide and large, longer than the city. Ships pulled in along stone piers, though Adolin couldn't figure out how they got back out again. Hook the Mandras to the stern and pull them out that way? The shore was marked by long warehouses set in rows, which marred the view of the city proper, in Adolin's opinion. The ship drew up at a berth on a specific pier, guided by a Reacher with semaphore. Eco's sailors unlatched a piece of the hull, which unfolded to steps, and a sailor hiked down immediately to greet another group of Reachers. These began unlatching the Mandras with long hooks, leading them away. As each flying spren was released from the rigging, the ship sank a little farther into the bead ocean. Eventually, it seemed to settle onto some braces and steady there. Pattern came over, humming to himself and meeting the rest of them as they gathered on the deck. Eco stepped up, gesturing.
A deal fulfilled and a bond kept.
Thank you, Captain, Adolin said, shaking Eco's hand.
Eco returned the gesture awkwardly. He obviously knew what to do, but was unpracticed at it.
You're sure you won't take us the rest of the way to the portal between realms?
I'm certain, Eco said firmly. The region around cultivation's perpendicularity has gained a poor reputation of late. Too many ships vanishing.
What about Thalen City? Kaladin asked. Could you take us there?
No. I unload goods here and then head east, away from trouble. And if you'll accept a little advice, stay in Shadesmar. The physical realm is not a welcoming place these days.
We'll take that under advisement, Adolin said.
Is there anything we should know about the city? Don't stray too far outside. With human cities nearby, there will be anger spren in the area. Try not to draw too many lesser spren, and maybe see if you can find a place to tie up that deadeye of yours. He pointed. The dock registrar is that building ahead of us with the blue paint. There you'll find a list of ships willing to take on passengers, but you'll have to go to each one individually and make sure they are equipped to take humans, and haven't already booked all their cabins. The building next to that is a money changer where you can trade Stormlight for notes of exchange.
He shook his head.
My daughter used to work there before she ran off chasing stupid dreams. He bade them farewell, and the group of travelers walked down the gangway onto the docks. Curiously, Syl still wore an illusion, making her face an Alethi tan, her hair black, her clothing red. Was being an honor spren really that big a deal?
So, Adolin said as they reached the pier, how are we going to do this? In the city, I mean.
I've counted out our marks, Shallan said, holding up a bag of spears. It's been long enough since they were renewed. They'll almost certainly lose their stormlight in the next few days. A few have already gone out. We might as well trade for supplies. We can keep the bromes and the larger gemstones for surge binding.
First stop is the money changer, then, Adolin said.
After that, we should see if we can buy more rations, Kaladin said, just in case. And we need to look for passage.
But to where? Azure said. The Perpendicularity or Thalen City?
Let's see what our options are, Adolin decided. Maybe there will be a ship to one destination, but not the other. Let's send one group to inquire with ships and another to get supplies. Shallan, do you have a preference which you'd rather do?
I'll look for passage, she said. I have experience with it. I made a lot of trips when chasing down Yasna.
Sounds good, Adolin said. We should put one Radiant in each group, so Bridge Boy and Syl, you'll go with me. Pattern and Azure, we'll go with Shallan.
Maybe I should help Shallan,
Syl began.
We'll need a spren with us, Adolin said, to explain culture here. Let's go trade in those spears first, though.
102. Celebrant. Mu'alakh was said to grant visions of the future at different times, but most commonly at the transition point between realms, when a soul was nearing the Tranquiline Halls. From Hesse's Mythica, page 144. Kaladin hiked through the city with Adolin and Syl. The money changing had gone quickly, and they'd left the spren of Adolin's sword with the others. After Shallan had taken the Deadeye's hand, she had remained behind. Reaching this city marked a welcome step forward toward finally getting out of this place and reaching Dalinar. Unfortunately, a brand new city full of unknown threats didn't encourage him to relax. The city wasn't as densely populated as most human ones, but the variety of spren was stunning. Reachers like Eco and his sailors were common, but there were also spren that looked much like Adolin's sword, at least before she'd been killed. They were made entirely of vines, though they had crystal hands and wore human clothing. Equally common were spren with inky black skin that shone with a variety of colors when light hit them right. Their clothing seemed part of them, like that of the cryptics and honor spren.
A small group of cryptics passed nearby, huddling close together as they walked. Each had a head with a slightly different pattern. There were other Spren with skin like cracked stone, molten light shining from within. Still others had skin the color of old white ashes, and when Kaladin saw one of these point toward something, the skin stretching at the joint of his arm disintegrated and blew away, revealing the joint and knobs of the humerus. The skin quickly regrew. The variety reminded Kaladin of the costumes of the Cult of Moments, though he didn't spot a single honor spren. And it didn't seem like the other spren mixed much. Humans were rare enough that the three of them, including Syl, imitating an Alethi, turned heads. Buildings were constructed using bricks in a variety of colors, or blocks of many different types of stone. Each building was a hodgepodge of materials with no pattern Kaladin could determine. "How do they get building materials?" Kaladin asked as they followed the money changers' instructions toward the nearby market. "Are there quarries on this side?" Syl frowned. She cocked her head. "You know, I'm not sure. I think maybe we make it appear on this side, somehow from yours, like Eco did with the ice."
"They seem to wear whatever," Adolin said, pointing. "That's an Alethi officer's coat over an Azish scribe's vest. Tashiki wrap, worn with trousers, and there's almost a full Thalen Telemco, but they're missing the boots."
"No children," Kaladin noticed.
"There have been a few," Syl said. "They just don't look little, like human children."
"How does that even work?" Adolin said.
"Well, it's certainly less messy than your method."
She scrunched her face up.
"We're made of power, bits of gods. There are places where that power coalesces and parts start to be aware. You go and then come back with a child, I think."
Adolin chuckled.
"What?"
Kaladin asked.
"That's actually not that different from what my nanny told me when I asked her where children came from. A nonsense story about parents baking a new child out of creme clay."
"It doesn't happen often,"
Syl said as they passed a group of the ash-colored spren sitting around a table and watching the crowds. They eyed the humans with overt hostility, and one flicked fingers toward Kaladin. Those fingers exploded to bits of dust, leaving bones that grew back the flesh.
"Raising children doesn't happen often?" Adolin asked.
Syl nodded.
"It's rare. Most spren will go hundreds of years without doing it."
"Hundreds of years? Storms," Kaladin whispered, considering it. "Most of these spren are that old?"
"Or older," Syl said. "But aging isn't the same with spren. Like time isn't. We don't learn as fast or change much without a bond."
Towers in the city's center showed the time by way of fires burning in a set of vertical holes, so they could judge how to meet back with the others in an hour as agreed. The market turned out to be mostly roofless stalls open to the air with goods piled on tables. Even in comparison to the improvised market of Yirithiru, this seemed ephemeral to Kaladin. But there were no storm winds to worry about here, so it probably made sense. They passed a clothing stall, and of course Adolin insisted on stopping. The oily spren who managed the place had an odd, very terse way of talking, with a strange use of words. But it did speak Alethi, unlike most of Iko's crew. Kaladin waited for the prince to finish until Syl stepped up and presented herself in an oversized poncho tied with a belt. On her head she wore a large floppy hat.
"What's that?" Kaladin asked.
"Clothes."
"Why do you need clothes? Yours are built in."
"Those are boring."
"Can't you change them?"
"Take stormlight on this side," she said. "Plus, the dress is part of my essence, so I'm actually walking around naked all the time."
"It's not the same."
"Easy for you to say. We bought you clothing. You have three sets."
"Three?" he said, looking down at his clothing. "I have my uniform, and this one Eco gave me."
"Plus the one you're wearing underneath that one."
"Underwear?"
Kaladin said.
Yeah? That means you have 3 sets of clothing while I have none.
We need 2 sets so one can be washed while we wear the other.
Just so you won't be stinky.
She rolled her eyes in an exaggerated way.
Look, you can give these to Shallan when I get bored with them. You know she likes hats.
That was true. He sighed, and when Adolin returned with another set of underclothing for each of them, along with a skirt for Shallan, Kaladin had him haggle for the clothing Syl was wearing, too. The prices were shockingly cheap, using a tiny fraction of the money from their writ. They continued on, passing stalls that sold building materials. According to the signs Syl could read, some items were far more expensive than others. Syl seemed to think the difference had to do with how permanent the thing was in Shadesmar, which made Kaladin worry for the clothing they'd bought. They found a place selling weapons, and Adolin tried to negotiate while Kaladin browsed. Some kitchen knives, a few hand axes, and sitting in a locked, glass-topped box, a long, thin, silvery chain.
"You like?"
the shopkeeper asked. She was made of vines, her face formed as if from green string, and wore a hava with a crystal safe hand exposed.
"Only 1,000 bromes of stormlight."
1,000 bromes?" Kaladin asked. He looked down at the box, which was locked to the table and guarded by small orange spren that looked like people.
"No, thanks."
The pricing here really was bizarre. The swords proved more expensive than Adolin wanted, but he did buy them 2 harpoons, and Kaladin felt a lot more secure once one was placed in his hands. Walking on, Kaladin noted that Syl was hunkered down in her oversized poncho, her hair tucked into the collar and her hat pulled down to shadow her face. It seemed like she didn't trust Shallan's illusion to keep her from being recognized as an honor spren. The food stall they found had mostly more cans, like those on the ship. Adolin started haggling, and Kaladin settled in for another wait, scanning those who passed on the pathway for danger. He found his eyes drawn, however, to a stall across from them, selling art. Kaladin had never had much time for art. Either the picture depicted something useful, like a map, or it was basically pointless. And yet, nestled among the paintings for display was a small one painted from thick strokes of oil, white and red with lines of black. When he looked away, he found himself drawn back toward it, studying the way the highlights played off those dark lines.
"Like 9 shadows," he thought, "with a figure kneeling in the middle."
The ashen spren waved excitedly, pointing to the east and then making a cutting motion. She spoke a language Shallan couldn't understand, but fortunately Pattern could interpret.
"Ah," he said. "Yes, I see. She will not sail back to cultivation's perpendicularity. No, she will not go."
"Same excuse?" Shallan asked.
"Yes. Void spren sailing warships and demanding tribute from any who approach. Oh, she says she would rather trade with honor spren than take another trip to the perpendicularity. I think this is an insult. Ha ha ha.
Void spren," Azure said. "Can she at least explain what that means?" The ashen spren began speaking quickly after Pattern asked.
"There are many varieties," she says. "Some of golden light, others are red shadows. Curious, yes. And it sounds like some of the fused are with them. Men with shells that can fly. I did not know this."
"What?"
Azure prompted. "Shadesmar has been changing these last months," Pattern explained. "Void spren have arrived mysteriously just west of the Nexus of Imagination, near Marat, or Tukar, on your side. And they have sailed up and seized the perpendicularity. She says, you need but spit into a crowd and you'll find one these days. Ha ha ha. I do not think she actually has spit."
Shallan and Azure shared a look as the sailor retreated onto her ship, to which mandras were being harnessed. The spren of Adolin's sword lingered nearby, seeming content to stay where told. Passers-by looked away from her, as if embarrassed to see her there. "Well, the dock registrar was right," Azure said, folding her arms. "No ships sailing toward the peaks or toward Thalen City. Those destinations are too close to enemy holdings." "Maybe we should try for the Shattered Plains instead," Shallan said. That meant going east, a direction ships were more likely to travel these days. It would mean going away from both what Kaladin and Azure wanted, but at least it would be something. If they got there, she'd still need to find a way to engage the Oathgate on this side. What if she failed? She imagined them trapped in some far-off location surrounded by beads, slowly starving. "Let's keep asking the ships on our list," she said, leading the way. The next ship in line was a long, stately vessel, made of white wood with golden trim. Its entire presentation seemed to say, "Good luck affording me." Even the mandras being led toward it from one of the warehouses wore gold harnesses. According to the list from the dock registrar, this was heading someplace called Lasting Integrity, which was to the southwest. That was kind of the direction Kaladin wanted to go. So Shallan had Pattern stop one of the grooms and ask if the captain of the ship would be likely to take human passengers. The groom, a spren that looked like she was made of fog or mist, merely laughed and walked off as if she'd heard a grand joke. "I suppose," Azure said, "we should take that for a no." The next ship in line was a sleek vessel that looked fast to Shallan's untrained eyes. A good choice, the registrar had noted, and likely to be welcoming toward humans. Indeed, a spren working on the deck waved as they approached. He put one booted foot up on the side of his ship and looked down with a grin. What kind of spren, Shallan thought, has skin like cracked rock? He glowed deep within, as if molten on the inside. "Humans?" he called in Vaden, reading Shallan's hair as a sign of her heritage. "You're far from home. Or close, I suppose. Just in the wrong realm." "We're looking for passage," Shallan called up. "Where are you sailing?"
"East," he said. "Toward Freelight."
"Could we potentially negotiate passage?"
"Sure,"
he called down.
"Always interesting to have humans aboard. Just don't eat my pet chicken. Ha! But negotiations will have to wait. We've got an inspection soon. Come back in a half hour."
The dock registrar had mentioned this. An official inspection of the ships happened at first hour every day. Shallan and the team backed off, and she suggested returning to their meeting place near the dock registrar. As they approached, Shallan could see that Iko's ship was already under inspection by a dock official, another spren made of vines and crystal. "Maybe we could convince Iko to take us if we just tried harder. Perhaps..." Azure's breath caught, and she grabbed Shallan by the shoulder, yanking her into an alley between two warehouses, out of sight of the ship.
"Damnation."
"What?" Shallan demanded, as Pattern and, lethargically, Adolin's spren joined them.
"Look up there," Azure said, "talking with Iko on the poop deck."
Shallan frowned, then peeked out, spotting what she'd missed earlier. A figure stood up there, with the marbled skin of a parchman. He floated a foot or two off the deck, next to Iko, looming like a stern tutor over a foolish student. The spren with the vines and crystal body walked up, reporting to this one.
"Perhaps," Azure said, "we should have asked who runs the inspections."
Kaladin's harpoon drew nervous glances as he crossed the pathway between stalls to get a closer look at the painting. Can spren even be hurt in this realm? A part of him wondered. The sailors wouldn't carry harpoons if things couldn't be killed on this side, right? He'd have to ask Syl, once she was done interpreting for Adolin. Kaladin stepped up to the painting. The ones beside it showed far more technical prowess. They were capable portraits, perfectly capturing their human subjects. This one was sloppy by comparison. It looked like the painter had simply taken a knife covered in paint and slopped it onto the canvas, making general shapes. Haunting, beautiful shapes. Mostly reds and whites, but with a figure at the center, throwing out 9 shadows. Dalinar, he thought. I failed Elokar. After all we went through, after the rains and confronting Moash, I've failed. And I lost your city. He reached up his fingers to touch the painting.
Marvelous, isn't it?
A Spren said. Kaladin jumped, sheepishly lowering his fingers. The proprietor of this stall was a Reacher woman, short with a bronze ponytail.
It's a unique piece. Human, she said. From the far-off court of gods. A painting intended only for a divinity to see. It is exceptionally rare that one escapes being burned at the court and makes its way onto the market.
9 shadows, Kaladin said. The unmade?
This is a piece by Nenephra. It is said that each person who sees one of his masterworks sees something different. And to think I charge such a minuscule price, only 300 broms worth of stormlight. Truly times are difficult in the art market.
I... Haunting images from Kaladin's vision overlapped the stark wedges of paint on the canvas. He needed to reach Thalen City. He had to be there on time. What was that disturbance behind him? Kaladin shook out of his reverie and glanced over his shoulder just in time to see Adolin jogging toward him.
We have a problem, the prince said.
How could you not mention this? Shallan said to the little spren at the registrar office. How could you neglect to point out that Void Spren ruled the city?
I thought everyone knew, he said, vines curling and moving at the corners of his face. Oh, dear. Oh, my. Anger is not helpful, human. I am a professional. It is not my job to explain things you should already know.
He's still on Eco's ship, Azure said, looking out the office window. Why is he still on Eco's ship?
That is odd, the Spren said. Each inspection usually takes only 13 minutes.
Damnation. Shallan breathed out, trying to calm herself. Coming back to the registrar had been a calculated risk. He was probably working with the Fused, but they hoped to intimidate him into talking. When did it happen? Shallan asked. My Spren friend told us this was a free city.
It's been months now, the Vine Spren said. Oh, they don't have firm control here, mind you. Just a few officials and promises from our leaders to follow. Too Fused check in on us now and then. I think the other is quite insane. Kirill, who is running the inspections, well, he might be mad too, actually. You see, when he gets angry,
damnation, Azure cursed. What? He just set Eco's ship on fire.
Kaladin ran back across the street to find Syl a center of activity. She had pulled her oversized hat down to obscure her face, but a collection of Spren stood around the food stall, pointing at her and talking. Kaladin shoved his way through, took Syl by the arm, and pulled her away from the stall. Adolin followed, holding his harpoon in one hand and a sack of food in the other. He looked threateningly toward the Spren and the gathered crowd, who didn't give chase. They recognize you, Kaladin said to Syl, even with the illusory skin color.
Maybe.
Syl! She held to her hat with one hand, her other arm in his hand, as he towed her through the street.
So, you know how I mentioned I snuck away from the other honor spren?
Yes.
So there might have been an enormous reward for my return. Posted in basically every port in Shadesmar, with my description and some pictures. Yeah.
You've been forgiven, Kaladin said. The Stormfather has accepted your bond to me. Your siblings are watching Bridge 4, investigating potential bonds themselves.
That's kind of recent, Kaladin. And I doubt I've been forgiven. The others on the Shattered Plains wouldn't talk to me. As far as they're concerned, I'm a disobedient child. There's still an incredible reward in Stormlight to be given to the person that delivers me to the Honor Spren capital, Lasting Integrity.
And you didn't think this was important to tell me?
Sure I did. Right now.
They stopped to allow Adolin to catch up. The Spren back at the food stall were still talking. Storms, this news would spread throughout Celebrant before long. Kaladin glared at Syl, who pulled down into the oversized poncho she'd bought.
Azure is a bounty hunter, she said in a small voice, and I'm kind of like a Spren Light Eyes. I didn't want you to know, in case you hated me like you hate them.
Kaladin sighed, taking her by the arm again and pulling her toward the docks.
I should have known this disguise wouldn't work, she added. I'm obviously too beautiful and interesting to hide.
News of this might make it hard to get passage, Kaladin said. He stopped in the street. Is that smoke up ahead?
The fused touched down on the quay, tossing Eco to the ground of the docks. Behind, Eco's ship had become a raging bonfire. The other sailors and inspectors scrambled down the gangway in a frantic jumble. Shallan watched from the window, her breath caught as the fuse lifted a few inches off the ground, then glided toward the registrar's building. She sucked in Stormlight by reflex. "Look frightened," she said to the others. She grabbed Adolin Spren by the arm and pulled her to the side of the clerk's room. The fuse burst in and found them cringing, wearing the faces of sailors that Shallan had sketched. Pattern was the oddest one, his strange head needing to be covered by a hat to have any semblance of looking realistic.
"Please don't notice we're the same sailors as on the ship. Please."
The fused ignored them, gliding up to the frightened Vine Spren behind the desk.
"That ship was hiding human criminals," Pattern whispered, translating the fused's conversation with the registrar. "They had a hydrator and remnants of human food eaten on the deck. There are two or three humans, one Honor Spren and one Ink Spren. Have you seen these criminals?"
The Vine Spren cringed down by the desk.
"They went to the market for needed supplies. They asked me for ships that would get them passage to the Perpendicularity."
"You hid this from me?"
"Why does everyone assume I'll just tell them things? Oh, I need questions, not assumptions."
The fused regarded him with a cold glare.
"Put that out,"
he said, gesturing toward the fire.
"Use the city's sand stores if needed."
"Yes, great one. If I might say, starting fires on the docks is an unwise—"
"You may not say. When you finish putting out the fire, clear your things from this office. You are to be replaced immediately."
The fused charged out of the room, letting in the scent of smoke. Eco's ship foundered, the blaze flaring high. Nearby, sailors from other ships were frantically trying to control their mandras and move their vessels away.
Oh my," said the Spren behind the desk.
He looked to them.
You are a radiant? The old oaths are spoken again?"
"Yes," Shallan said, helping Adolin Spren to her feet. The frightened little Spren sat up straighter.
"Oh, glorious day! Glorious! We have waited so long for the honor of men to return."
He stood up and gestured.
"Go, please, get on a ship. I will stall, yes, I will, if that one comes back. Oh, but go quickly!"
Kaladin sensed something on the air. Perhaps it was the flapping of clothing, familiar to him after hours spent riding the winds. Perhaps it was the postures of the people farther down the street. He reacted before he understood what it was, grabbing Syl and Adolin, pulling them all into a tent at the edge of the market. A fused sword passed outside, its shadow trailing behind, pointing the wrong direction.
"Storms," Adolin said. "Nice work, Cal."
The tent was occupied only by a single bewildered Spren made of smoke, looking odd in a green cap and what seemed to be horn-eater clothing.
"Out,"
Kaladin said, the smell of smoke on the air filling him with dread. They hurried down an alleyway between warehouses, out onto the docks. Farther down, Eco's ship burned brilliantly. There was chaos on the docks as Spren ran in all directions, shouting in their strange language. Syl gasped, pointing at a ship bedecked in white and gold.
"We have to hide. Now!"
"Honor, Spren," Kaladin said.
"Yeah."
"Pull down your hat, go back into the alley," Kaladin scanned the crowd. "Adolin, do you see the others?"
"No," he said. "Ishar's soul, there's no water to put that fire out. It will burn for hours. What happened?"
One of Eco's sailors stepped from the crowd.
"I saw a flash from something the fused was holding. I think he intended to frighten Eco, but started the fire by accident."
"Wait," Kaladin thought. "Was that a Lethe?"
"Shallan?"
he asked as four Reachers gathered around.
"I'm right here," said a different one. "We are in trouble. The only ship that might have agreed to give us passage is that one there."
"The one sailing away at full speed,"
Kaladin said with a sigh.
"Nobody else would consider taking us on," Azure said. "And they were all heading the wrong directions anyway. We're about to be stranded."
"We could try fighting our way onto a ship," Kaladin said. "Take control of it, maybe?" Adolin shook his head.
"I think that would take long enough and make enough trouble that the fused would find us."
"Well, maybe I could fight him," Kaladin said.
"Only one enemy. I should be able to take him."
"Using all our stormlight in the process?"
Shallan asked.
"I'm just trying to think of something."
"Guys," Syl said, "I might have an idea.
A great, bad idea."
"The fused went looking for you,"
Shallan said to Kaladin.
"It flew to the market."
"It passed us."
"Guys."
"Not for long, though. It's going to turn around soon."
"Turns out Syl has a bounty on her head."
"Guys."
"We need a plan," Kaladin said. "If nobody..."
He trailed off. Syl had started running toward the majestic white and gold ship, which was slowly being pulled away from the docks. She threw down her poncho and hat, then screamed up at the ship while running along the pier beside it.
"Hey!"
she screamed.
"Hey, look down here!"
The vessel stopped ponderously, handlers slowing its mandras. Three blue-white honor Spren appeared at the side, looking down with utter shock.
"Sylphrenna? The ancient daughter?"
one shouted.
"That's me,"
she shouted back.
"You'd better catch me before I scamper away. Wow, I'm feeling capricious today. I might just vanish again, off to where nobody can find me."
It worked. A gangway dropped, and Syl scrambled up onto the ship, followed by the rest of them. Kaladin went last, watching nervously over his shoulder, expecting the fuse to come after them at any moment. It did, but it stopped at the mouth of the alleyway, watching them board the ship. Honor Spren gave it pause, apparently. Aboard, Kaladin discovered that most of the sailors were those Spren made of fog or mist. One of these was tying Syl's arms together with rope. Kaladin tried to intervene, but Syl shook her head.
"Not now," she mouthed.
"Fine?" He would argue with the Honor Spren later. The ship pulled away, joining others that fled the city. The Honor Spren didn't pay much mind to Kaladin and the others, though one did take their harpoons, and another went through their pockets, confiscating their infused gemstones. As the city grew smaller, Kaladin caught sight of the fused hovering over the docks beside the smoke trail of a burning ship. It finally streaked off in the other direction.
103. Hypocrite.
Many cultures speak of the so-called death rattles that sometimes overtake people as they die. Tradition ascribes them to the Almighty, but I find too many to be seemingly prophetic. This will be my most contentious assertion, I am sure. But I think these are the effects of Moloch persisting in our current times. Proof is easy to provide. The effect is regionalized and tends to move across Roshar. This is the roving of the unmade. From Hesse's Mythica, page 170. Dalinar started awake in an unfamiliar place, lying on a floor of cut stone, his back stiff. He blinked sleepily, trying to orient himself. Storms, where was he? Soft sunlight shone through an open balcony on the far side of the room, and ethereal motes of dust danced in the streams of light. What were those sounds? They seemed like the voices of people, but muffled. Dalinar stood, then fastened the side of his uniform jacket, which had come undone. It had been, what, 3 days since his return from Yakoved? His excommunication from the Vorin Church? He remembered those days as a haze of frustration, sorrow, agony. And drink. A great deal of drink. He'd been using the stupor to drive away the pain. A terrible bandage for his wounds, blood seeping out on all sides. But so far, it had kept him alive. I know this room, he realized, glancing at the mural on the ceiling. I saw it in one of my visions. A high storm must have come while he passed out. Stormfather, Dalinar called, his voice echoing. Stormfather, why have you sent me a vision? We agreed they are too dangerous. Yes, he remembered this place well. This was the vision where he'd met Noadon, author of The Way of Kings. Why wasn't it playing out as it had before? He and Noadon had walked to the balcony, talked for a time, then the vision had ended. Dalinar started toward the balcony, but storms, that light was so intense. It washed over him, making his eyes water, and he had to raise his hands to shield his eyes. He heard something behind him, scratching. He turned, putting his back to the brilliance, and spotted a door on the wall. It swung open easily beneath his touch, and he stepped out of the loud sunlight to find himself in a circular room. He shut the door with a click. This chamber was much smaller than the previous one, with a wooden floor. Windows in the walls looked out at a clear sky. A shadow passed over one of these, like something enormous moving in front of the sun. But how could the sun be pointed this direction, too? Dalinar looked over his shoulder at the wooden door. No light peeked underneath it. He frowned and reached for the handle, then paused, hearing the scratching once more. Turning, he saw a large desk heaped with papers by the wall. How had he missed that earlier? A man sat at the desk, lit by a loose diamond, writing with a reed pen. Noadon had aged. In the previous vision, the king had been young. But now his hair was silver, his skin marked by wrinkles. It was the same man, though, same face shape, same beard that came to a point. He wrote with focused concentration. Dalinar stepped over. The Way of Kings, he whispered. I'm watching it be written.
Actually, Noadon said, it's a shopping list. I'll be cooking shinloaf bread today, if I can get the ingredients. It always breaks people's brains. Grain was not meant to be so fluffy.
What? Dalinar scratched at the side of his head. Noadon finished with a flourish and tossed the pen down. He threw back his chair and stood, grinning like a fool, and grabbed Dalinar by the arms.
Good to see you again, my friend. You've been having a hard time of it lately, haven't you?
You have no idea, Dalinar whispered, wondering who Noadon saw him as. In the previous vision, Dalinar had appeared as one of Noadon's advisors. They'd stood together on the balcony as Noadon contemplated a war to unite the world. A drastic resort intended to prepare mankind for the next desolation. Could that morose figure have really become this spry and eager? And where had this vision come from? Hadn't the Stormfather told Dalinar that he'd seen them all?
Come, Noadon said. Let's go to the market. A little shopping to turn your mind from your troubles.
Shopping?
Yes. You shop, don't you?
I usually have people do that for me.
Ah, but of course you do, Noadon said. Very like you to miss a simple joy so you can get to something more important. Well, come on. I'm the king. You can't very well say no now, can you?
Noadon led Dalinar back through the door. The light was gone. They crossed to the balcony, which last time had overlooked death and desolation. Now it looked out on a bustling city full of energetic people and rolling carts. The sound of the place crashed into Dalinar as if it had been suppressed until that moment. Laughing, chatting, calling. Wagons creaking, chulls bleeding. The men wore long skirts, tied at the waists by wide girdles, some of which came all the way up over their stomachs. Above that, they had bare chests or wore simple overshirts. The outfits resembled the takama Dalinar had worn when younger, though of a far, far older style. The tubular gowns on the women were even stranger, made of layered, small rings of cloth with tassels on the bottom. They seemed to ripple as they moved. The women's arms were bare up to the shoulders, no safe hand covering.
In the previous vision I spoke the dawn chant, Dalinar remembered. The words that gave Nabani's scholars a starting point to translate ancient texts. How do we get down?
Dalinar asked, seeing no ladder. Noadon leaped off the side of the balcony. He laughed, falling and sliding along a cloth banner tied between a tower window and a tent below. Dalinar cursed, leaning forward, worried for the old man until he spotted Noadon glowing. He was a surge binder, but Dalinar had known that from the last vision, hadn't he? Dalinar walked back to the writing chamber and drew the stormlight from the diamond that Noadon had been using. He returned, then heaved himself off the balcony, aiming for the cloth Noadon had used to break his fall. Dalinar hit it at an angle and used it like a slide, keeping his right foot forward to guide his descent. Near the bottom, he flipped off the banner, grabbing its edge with two hands and hanging there for an instant before dropping with a thump beside the king. Noadon clapped.
I thought you wouldn't do it.
I have practice following fools in their reckless pursuits.
The old man grinned, then scanned his list.
This way,
he said, pointing.
I can't believe you're out shopping by yourself. No guards?
I walked all the way to Urethiro on my own. I think I can manage this.
You didn't walk all the way to Urethiro, Dalinar said. You walked to one of the Oath Gates, then took that to Urethiro.
Misconception, Noadon said. I walked the whole way, though I did require some help to reach Urethiru's caverns. That is no more a cheat than taking a ferry across a river.
He bustled through the market, and Dalinar followed, distracted by the colorful clothing everyone was wearing. Even the stones of the buildings were painted in vibrant colors. He'd always imagined the past as dull. Statues from ancient times were weathered, and he'd never considered that they might have been painted so brightly. What of Noadon himself? In both visions, Dalinar had been shown someone he did not expect. The young Noadon, considering war, now the elderly one, glib and whimsical. Where was the deep-thinking philosopher who had written The Way of Kings?
Remember, Dalinar told himself, this isn't really him. The person I'm talking to is a construct of the vision.
Though some people in the market recognized their king, his passing didn't cause much of a stir. Dalinar spun as he saw something move beyond the buildings, a large shadow that passed between two structures, tall and enormous. He stared in that direction, but didn't see it again. They entered a tent where a merchant was selling exotic grains. The man bustled over and hugged Noadon in a way that should have been improper for a king. Then the two started haggling like scribes. The rings on the merchant's fingers flashed as he gestured at his wares. Dalinar lingered near the side of the tent, taking in the scents of the grains in the sacks. Outside, something made a distant thud, then another. The ground shook, but nobody reacted.
Your Majesty?
Dalinar asked. Noadon ignored him. A shadow passed over the tent. Dalinar ducked, judging the form of the shadow, the sounds of crashing footfalls.
Your Majesty!
He shouted, Fearspren growing up around him.
We're in danger!
The shadow passed, and the footfalls grew distant.
Deal!
Noadon said to the merchant.
And well argued, you swindler. Make sure to buy Lani something nice with the extra spheres you got off me.
The merchant bellowed a laughing reply.
You think you got the worst of that? Storms, your Majesty. You argue like my grandmother when she wants the last spoonful of jam.
Did you see that shadow?
Dalinar asked Noadon.
Have I told you, Noadon replied, where I learned to make shin loaf bread? It wasn't in Shin Cock Nish, if that's what you were going to reply.
I...
Dalinar looked in the direction the enormous shadow had gone.
No, you haven't told me. It was at war, Noadon said. In the west. One of those senseless battles in the years following the desolation. I don't even remember what caused it. Someone invaded someone else, and that threatened our trade through Makabakam. So off we went. Well, I ended up with a scouting group on the edge of the Shin border. So you see, I tricked you just now. I said I wasn't in Shin Cocknish, and I wasn't. But I was right next to it. My troops occupied a small village beneath one of the passes. The matron who cooked for us accepted my military occupation without complaint. She didn't seem to care which army was in charge. She made me bread every day. And I liked it so much she asked if I wanted to learn.
He trailed off. In front of him, the merchant set weights on one side of his large set of scales, representing the amount Noadon had purchased, then started pouring grain into a bowl on the other side of the scale. Golden, captivating grain, like the light of captured flames.
What happened to the cook woman? Dalinar asked.
Something very unfair, Noadon said. It's not a happy story. I considered putting it into the book, but decided my story would best be limited to my walk to Urethiru.
He fell silent, contemplative.
He reminds me of Taravangian, Dalinar suddenly thought. How odd.
You're having trouble, my friend, Noadon said. Your life, like that of the woman, is unfair.
Being a ruler is a burden, not merely a privilege, Dalinar said. You taught me that. But storms, Noadon. I can't see any way out. We've gathered the monarchs, yet the drums of war beat in my ears, demanding. For every step I make with my allies, we seem to spend weeks deliberating. The truth whispers in the back of my mind. I could best defend the world if I could simply make the others do as they should.
Noadon nodded.
So why don't you?
You didn't.
I tried and failed. That led me to a different path.
You're wise and thoughtful. I'm a warmonger, Noadon. I've never accomplished anything without bloodshed.
He heard them again. The tears of the dead, Evie, the children, flames burning a city. He heard the fire roar in delight at the feast. The merchant ignored them, busy trying to get the grain to balance. The weighted side was still heavier. Noadon set a finger on the bowl with the grain and pushed down, making the sides even.
That will do, my friend.
But, the merchant said,
give the excess to the children, please. After all that haggling, you know I'd have donated some if you'd asked. And miss the fun of negotiating?
Noadon said. He borrowed the merchant's pen, then crossed an item off his list.
There is satisfaction, he said to Dalinar, in creating a list of things you can actually accomplish, then removing them one at a time. As I said, a simple joy.
Unfortunately, I'm needed for bigger things than shopping.
Isn't that always the problem? Tell me, my friend, you talk about your burdens and the difficulty of the decision. What is the cost of a principle?
The cost? There shouldn't be a cost to being principled.
Oh? What if making the right decision created a spren who instantly blessed you with wealth, prosperity, and unending happiness? What then? Would you still have principles? Isn't a principle about what you give up, not what you gain?
So it's all negative, Dalinar said. Are you implying that nobody should have principles because there's no benefit to them?
Hardly, Noadon said. But maybe you shouldn't be looking for life to be easier because you choose to do something that is right. Personally, I think life is fair. It's merely that often you can't immediately see what balances it.
He wagged the finger he'd used to tip the merchant's scales.
If you'll forgive a somewhat blatant metaphor, I've grown fond of them. You might say I wrote an entire book about them.
This is different from the other visions, Dalinar said. What's going on?
The thumping from before returned. Dalinar spun, then charged out of the tent, determined to get a look at the thing. He saw it above the buildings, a stone creature with an angular face and red spots glowing deep in its rocky skull.
Storms, and he had no weapon.
Noadon stepped from the tent, holding his bag of grain. He looked up and smiled. The creature leaned down, then offered a large, skeletal hand. Noadon touched it with his own, and the creature stilled.
"This is quite the nightmare you've created," Noadon said. "What does that thunderclast represent, I wonder?"
"Pain," Dalinar said, backing away from the monster. "Tears. Burdens. I'm a lie, Noadon. A hypocrite."
"Sometimes. A hypocrite is nothing more than a man who is in the process of changing."
Wait, hadn't Dalinar said that? Back when he'd felt stronger? More certain?
Other thumps sounded in the city. Hundreds of them. Creatures approaching from all sides, shadows in the sun.
All things exist in three realms, Dalinar,
Noadon said.
The physical, where you are now. The cognitive, what you see yourself as being. The spiritual, the perfect you, the person beyond pain and error and uncertainty.
Monsters of stone and horror surrounded him, heads cresting roofs, feet crushing buildings.
You've said the oaths, Noadon called, but do you understand the journey? Do you understand what it requires? You've forgotten one essential part, one thing that without which there can be no journey.
The monsters slammed fists toward Dalinar and he shouted.
What is the most important step a man can take?
Dalinar awoke, huddled in his bed in Urethiru, asleep in his clothing again. A mostly empty bottle of wine rested on the table. There was no storm. It hadn't been a vision. He buried his face in his hands, trembling. Something bloomed inside of him. A recollection. Not really a new memory. Not one he'd completely forgotten, but it suddenly became as crisp as if he'd experienced it yesterday. The night of Gavilar's funeral.
104. Strength. Ashurtmarn, the heart of the revel, is the final of the three great, mindless unmade. His gift to men is not prophecy or battle focus, but a lust for indulgence. Indeed, the great debauchery recorded from the court of Bayala in 480, which led to dynastic collapse, might be attributable to the influence of a Shirtmarn. From Hesse's Mythica, page 203. Navani Colin had some practice holding a kingdom together. During Gavilar's last days, he had gone strange. Few knew how dark he'd grown, but they had seen the eccentricity. Jasnah had written about that, of course. Jasnah somehow found time to write about everything, from her father's biography to gender relations to the importance of Chul breeding cycles on the southern slopes of the Horneater Peaks. Navani strode through the hallways of Urethiru, joined by a nice burly group of Bridge Four Windrunners. As Gavilar had grown more and more distracted, Navani herself had worked to keep squabbling Light Eyes from sundering the kingdom. But that had been a different kind of danger from the one she faced today. Today, her work had implications not only for one nation, but for the entire world. She burst into a room deep within the tower, and the four Light Eyes seated there scrambled to their feet, all but Sabariel, who appeared to be flipping through a stack of cards bearing pictures of women in compromising positions. Navani sighed, then nodded as Aladar gave her a respectful bow, light glinting off his bald head. Not for the first time, Navani wondered if his thin mustache and the tuft of beard on his bottom lip were compensation for his lack of hair. Hatham was there as well, refined, with rounded features and green eyes. As usual, his fashion choices stood out from everyone else. Orange, today. Brightness Bethab had come representing her husband. The men in the army tended to disrespect him for letting her do so, but that ignored the fact that marrying Mishina for her political acumen had been a wise and calculated move. The five men of Bridge Four arrayed themselves behind Navani. They had been surprised when she'd asked them to escort her. They didn't yet understand the authority they lent the throne. The Knights Radiant were the new power in the world, and politics swirled around them like eddies in a river. "Bright Lords and Bright Lady," Navani said, "I've come at your request and am at your service." Aladar cleared his throat, sitting.
"You know, Brightness, that we are the most loyal to your husband's cause."
"Or at the least," Sabariel added, "we're the ones hoping to get rich by throwing in our lot with him."
"My husband appreciates the support," Navani said, "regardless of motive. You create a stronger Alethkar, and therefore a stronger world."
"What's left of either one," Sabariel noted.
"Navani," Bright Lady Bethab said. She was a mousy woman with a pinched face. "We appreciate that you've taken the initiative in this difficult time." There was a glint to her orange eyes, as if she assumed Navani was enjoying her new power. "But the High Prince's absence is not advantageous for morale. We know that Dalinar has returned to his distractions."
"The High Prince," Navani said, "is in mourning."
"The only thing he seems to be mourning," Sabariel said, "is the fact that people won't bring him bottles of wine fast enough for—"
"Damnation, Turinad!" Navani snapped. "That's enough!"
Sabariel blinked, then pocketed his cards.
"Sorry, Brightness."
"My husband," Navani said, "is still this world's best chance for survival. He will push through his pain. Until then, our duty is to keep the kingdom running."
Hatham nodded, beads on his coat glistening.
"This is, of course, our goal. But, Brightness, can you define what you mean by kingdom? You do know that Dalinar came to us and asked what we thought of this High King business."
That news wasn't commonly known yet. They'd planned an official announcement, and even had Elokar seal the papers before leaving. Yet Dalinar had delayed. She understood. He wanted to wait until Elokar and Adolin, who would become Colin High Prince in Dalinar's place, returned. And yet, as more and more time passed, the questions began to grow more pressing. What had happened to them in Kolinar? Where were they? Strength. They would return. The High King proclamation has not been made official, Navani said. I think it's best to pretend you don't know about it for now. And whatever you do, don't mention it to ELA or Amaram. Very well, Aladar said. But Brightness, we have other problems. Surely you've seen the reports. Hatham does an excellent job as High Prince of Works, but there isn't proper infrastructure. The tower has plumbing, but it keeps getting clogged, and the soulcasters work themselves to exhaustion dealing with the waste.
We can't continue pretending the tower can accommodate this population, Brightness Bethab said. Not without a very favorable supply deal from Aesir. Our emerald reserves, despite hunts on the Shattered Plains, are dwindling. Our water carts have to work non-stop.
Equally important, Brightness, Hatham added. We might be facing a severe labor shortage. We have soldiers or caravan men filling in hauling water or packing goods, but they don't like it. Menial carrying is beneath them. We're running low on lumber, Sabariel added. I've tried to claim the forests back near the war camps, but we used to have parchment to cut them. I don't know if I can afford to pay men to do the work instead. But if we don't start something, Thanadol might try to seize them. He's building himself quite the kingdom in the war camps. This is not a time, Hatham said softly, when we can afford weak leadership. It is not a time when a would-be king can spend his days locked in his rooms. I'm sorry. We are not in rebellion, but we are very concerned. Navani drew in a breath. Hold it together. Order was the very substance of rule. If things were organized, control could be asserted. She just had to give Dalinar time, even if deep down a part of her was angry. Angry that his pain so overshadowed her growing fear for Elokar and Adolin. Angry that he got to drink himself to oblivion, leaving her to pick up the pieces. But she had learned that nobody was strong all the time. Not even Dalinar Colin. Love wasn't about being right or wrong, but about standing up and helping when your partner's back was bowed. He would likely do the same for her one day.
"Tell us honestly, Brightness," Sabariel said, leaning forward. "What does the Blackthorn want? Is this all secretly a way for him to dominate the world?"
"Storms. Even they worried about it. And why shouldn't they? It made so much sense." "My husband wants unity," Navani said firmly. "Not dominion. You know as well as I do that we could have seized Thalen City. That would have led to selfishness and loss. There is no path through conquest to facing our enemy together." Aladar nodded slowly.
"I believe you, and I believe in him."
"But how do we survive?" Brightness Bethab said.
"This tower's gardens once grew food," Navani said. "We will figure out how it was done and we will grow here again. The tower once flowed with water. The baths and lavatories prove that. We will delve into the secrets of their fabrials and we will fix the plumbing problems. The tower is above the enemy's storm, supremely defensible and connected to the most important cities in the world. If there is a nation that can stand against the enemy, we will forge it here, with your help and my husband's leadership." They accepted that.
Bless the Almighty, they accepted it.
She made a mental note to burn a glyph word in thanks, then finally took a seat. Together they delved into the tower's most recent list of problems, talking through, as they'd done many times before, the dirty necessities of running a city. 3 hours later, she checked her arm fabrial, a mirror of the one Dalinar carried, with inset clock and newly designed pain rails. 3 hours and 12 minutes since the meeting had begun. Exhaustion Spren had collected to swirl around them all, and she called an end. They'd hashed out their immediate problems and would summon their various scribes to offer specific revisions. This would keep everyone going a little longer. And bless them, these four did want the Coalition to work. Aladar and Sabariel, for all their flaws, had followed Dalinar into the Dark of the Weeping and found damnation waiting there. Hatham and Bethab had been at the advent of the new storm and could see that Dalinar had been right. They didn't care that the Blackthorn was a heretic, or even whether he usurped the throne of Alethkar. They cared that he had a plan for dealing with the enemy, long term. After the meeting broke, Navani walked off down the strata-lined hallway, trailed by her bridgeman guards, two of whom carried sapphire lanterns. "I do apologize," she noted to them, "for how boring that must have been."
"We like boring, Brightness,"
Leighton, their leader today, said. He was a stocky man with short, curly hair.
"Hey, Hobber, anyone try to kill you in there?"
The gap-toothed bridgeman grinned his reply.
"Does Huyo's breath count?" "See, Brightness?" Leighton said. "New recruits might get bored by guard duty, but you'll never find a veteran complaining about a nice quiet afternoon full of not being stabbed."
"I can see the appeal," she said. "But surely it can't compare with soaring through the skies."
"That's true," Leighton said. "But we have to take turns, you know."
He meant using the honor blade to practice wind running.
"Cal has to return before we can do more than that."
To a man, they were absolutely certain he'd return, and showed the world jovial faces, though she knew not everything was perfect with them. Teft, for example, had been hauled before Aladar's magistrates 2 days ago. Public intoxication on fire moss. Aladar had quietly requested her seal to free him. No, all was not well with them. But as Navani led them down toward the basement library rooms, a different issue gnawed at her. Bright Lady Bethab's implication that Navani was eager for the chance to take over, while Dalinar was indisposed. Navani was not a fool. She knew how it looked to others. She'd married one king. After he died, she'd immediately gone after the next most powerful man in Alethkar. But she couldn't have people believing she was the power behind the throne. Not only would it undermine Dalinar, but it would grow tedious for her. She had no problem being a wife or mother to monarchs, but to be one herself, storms, what a dark path that would lead them all down. She and the bridgemen passed no fewer than 6 squads of sentries on their way to the library rooms with the murals and, more importantly, the hidden gemstone records. Arriving, she idled in the doorway, impressed by the operation that Jasnah had organized down here since Navani had been forced to step back from the research. Each gemstone had been removed from its individual drawer, catalogued, and numbered. While one group listened and wrote, others sat at tables, busy translating. The room buzzed with a low hum of discussion and scratching reeds, concentration spren dotting the air, like ripples in the sky. Jasnah strolled along the tables, looking through pages of translations. As Navani entered, the bridgeman gathered around Renarin, who blushed, looking up from his own papers, which were covered in glyphs and numbers. He did look out of place in the room, the only man in uniform, rather than in the robes of an ardent or storm warden. "Mother," Jasnah said, not looking up from her papers, "we need more translators. Do you have any other scribes versed in classical Alethalan?" "I've lent you everyone I have. What is Renarin studying over there?" "Hmm? Oh, he thinks there might be a pattern to which stones were stored in which drawers. He's been working on it all day."
"And?"
"Nothing, which is not surprising. He insists he can find a pattern if he looks hard enough." Jasnah lowered her pages and looked at her cousin, who was joking with the men of Bridge 4. Storms, Navani thought. He truly looks happy. Embarrassed as they ribbed him, but happy. She'd worried when he had first joined Bridge 4. He was the son of a high prince. Decorum and distance were appropriate when dealing with enlisted soldiers. But when, before this, had she last heard him laugh? "Maybe," Navani said, "we should encourage him to take a break and go out with the bridgemen for the evening." "I'd rather keep him here," Jasnah said, flipping through her pages. "His powers need additional study." Navani would talk to Renarin anyway, and encourage him to go out more with the men. There was no arguing with Jasnah, any more than there was arguing with a boulder. You just stepped to the side and went around. "The translation goes well?" Navani asked. "Other than the bottleneck on numbers of scribes?" "We're lucky," Jasnah said, "that the gemstones were recorded so late in the life of the Radiance. They spoke a language we can translate. If it had been the Dawn Chant, that's close to being cracked." Jasnah frowned at that. Navani had thought the prospect of translating the Dawn Chant and writings lost to the Shadow Days would have excited her. Instead, it seemed to trouble her. "Have you found anything more about the Tower's fabrials in these gemstone records?" Navani asked. "I'll be certain to prepare a report for you, Mother, with details of each and every fabrial mentioned. So far, those references are few. Most are personal histories." "Damnation!" "Mother!" Jasnah said, lowering her pages. "What? I wouldn't have thought you would object to a few strong words now." "It's not the language, but the dismissal," Jasnah said. "Histories."
"Oh, right."
"History is the key to human understanding."
"Here we go.
We must learn from the past and apply that knowledge to our modern experience."
"Lectured by my own daughter again."
"The best indication of what human beings will do is not what they think, but what the record says similar groups have done in the past."
"Of course, Brightness."
Jasnah gave her a dry look, then set her papers aside. "I'm sorry, Mother. I've been dealing with a lot of lesser ardents today. My didactic side might have inflated."
"You have a didactic side? Dear, you hate teaching."
"Which explains my mood, I should think. A young scribe called for her from the other side of the room." Jasnah sighed, then went to answer the question. Jasnah preferred to work alone, which was odd, considering how good she was at getting people to do what she wanted. Navani liked groups, but of course Navani wasn't a scholar. Oh, she knew how to pretend, but all she really did was nudge here and there, perhaps provide an idea. Others did all the real engineering. She poked through the papers Jasnah had set aside. Perhaps her daughter had missed something in the translations. To her mind, the only scholarship of importance was stuffy, dusty writings of old philosophers. When it came to fabrials, Jasnah barely knew her pairings from her warnings. What was this? "The glyphs were scrawled in white on the High Prince's wall," the paper read. "We quickly ascertained the implement of writing to be a stone pried free near the window. This first sign was the roughest of them, the glyphs malformed. The reason for this later became apparent, as Prince Renarin was not versed in writing glyphs, save the numbers." The other pages were similar, talking about the strange numbers found around Dalinar's palace in the days leading up to the Everstorm. They'd been made by Renarin, whose Spren had given him warning that the enemy was preparing an assault. The poor boy, uncertain of his bond and frightened to speak out, had instead written the numbers where Dalinar would see them. It was a little odd, but in the face of everything else, it didn't really register. And, well, it was Renarin. Why had Jasnah collected all of these? "I have a description for you finally, Jasnah," another said. We've convinced the Radiant that Lift found in Yedaw to visit Azimir. Though she has not yet arrived, you can find sketches of her Spren companion here. It looks like the shimmer you see on a wall when you shine light through a crystal. Troubled, Navani set the sheets down before Yasna could return. She got a copy of the translated portions from the gemstones. Several young scribes were assigned to making these available. Then slipped out to go check on Dalinar.
105. Spirit, Mind, and Body. 6 years ago. Only the very most important people were allowed to watch Gavilar's holy interment. Dalinar stood at the front of the small crowd gathered in the royal catacombs of Kolinar, beneath the stone site of kings. Fires burned at the sides of the room, a primal light, traditional. Distinctly more alive than the light of spheres, it reminded him of the rift. But for once, that pain was overpowered by something new. A fresh wound. The sight of his brother lying dead on the slab.
"Spirit, mind, and body," the wizened Ardent said, her voice echoing in the stone catacomb. "Death is the separation of the three. The body remains in our realm to be reused. The spirit rejoins the pool of divine essence that gave it birth. And the mind goes to the tranquiline halls to find its reward."
Dalinar's nails bit his skin as he clenched his hands into fists, tight, to keep him from trembling.
"Gavilar the Majestic," the Ardent continued, "first king of Alethkar in the new Kolin dynasty, 32nd high prince of the Kolin princedom, heir of the Sunmaker and blessed of the Almighty. His accomplishments will be lauded by all, and his dominion extends to the hereafter. Already he leads men again on the battlefield, serving the Almighty in the true war against the Voidbringers."
The Ardent thrust a bony hand toward the small crowd.
"Our king's war has moved to the Tranquiline Halls. The end of our war for Roshar did not end our duty to the Almighty. Think upon your callings, men and women of Alethkar. Think of how you might learn here and be of use in the next world."
Yevana would use any available opportunity to preach. Dalinar clenched his hands tighter, angry at her, angry at the Almighty. Dalinar should not have lived to see his brother die. This was not the way it should have gone. He felt eyes on his back. Collected high princes and wives, important Ardents, Navani, Yasna, Elokar, Aesodon, Dalinar's sons. Nearby, High Prince Sabariel glanced at Dalinar, eyebrows raised. He seemed to be expecting something. "I'm not drunk, you idiot," Dalinar thought. "I'm not going to make a scene to amuse you." Things have been going better lately. Dalinar had started controlling his vices. He'd confined his drinking to monthly trips away from Kolinar, visiting outer cities. He said the trips were to let Elokar practice ruling without Dalinar looking over his shoulder, as Gavilar had been spending more and more time abroad. But during those trips, Dalinar drank himself to oblivion, letting himself escape the sounds of children crying for a few precious days. Then, when he returned to Kolinar, he controlled his drinking. And he'd never again yelled at his sons, as he had at poor Renarin during that day on the way back from the Shattered Plains. Adolin and Renarin were the only pure remnant of Evie. "If you control your drinking when back in Kolinar," a part of him challenged, "what happened at the feast? Where were you when Gavilar was fighting for his life?"
"We must use King Gavilar as a model for our own lives," the Ardent was saying. "We must remember that our lives are not our own. This world is but the skirmish to prepare us for the true war."
"And after that?"
Dalinar asked, looking up from Gavilar's corpse. The Ardent squinted, adjusting her spectacles.
"High Prince Dalinar?"
"After that, what?" Dalinar said. "After we win back the Tranquiline Halls, what then? No more war?
Is that when we finally get to rest?"
"You needn't worry, Blackthorn," Yavenna said. "Once that war is won, the Almighty will certainly provide for you another conquest."
She smiled comfortingly, then moved on to the ritual sayings. A series of kedeks, some traditional, others composed by female family members for the event. Ardents burned the poems as prayers in braziers. Dalinar looked back down at his brother's corpse, which stared upward, lifeless blue marbles replacing his eyes. "Brother," he'd said, "follow the codes tonight. There is something strange upon the winds." Dalinar needed something to drink, Stormit.
"You, always about dreams. My soul weeps. Farewell, weeping soul. My dreams about always you."
The poem slapped him harder than the others. He sought out Navani and knew instantly that the Kedek had been hers. Gazing straight ahead, she stood with one hand on Elikar's, King Elikar's, shoulder. So beautiful. Next to her, Yasna stood with arms wrapped around herself, eyes red. Navani reached toward her, but Yasna pulled away from the others and stalked off toward the palace proper. Dalinar wished he could do the same, but instead drew himself to attention. It was over. He'd never have a chance to live up to Gavilar's expectations. Dalinar would live the rest of his life as a failure to this man whom he had loved so dearly. The hall grew still, quiet save for the crinkling sound of paper burning in the fires. The soulcaster stood up, and old Yavenna stepped hastily backward. She wasn't comfortable with what was coming next. None of them were, judging by the shuffling feet, the coughs into hands. The soulcaster might have been male, might have been female. Hard to say with that hood up over their face. The skin beneath was colored like granite, cracked and chipped, and seemed to glow from within. The soulcaster regarded the corpse, head cocked, as if surprised to find a body here. They ran their fingers along Gavilar's jaw, then brushed the hair off his forehead.
"The only part of you that is true," the soulcaster whispered, tapping a stone that had replaced one of the king's eyes.
Then, light emerged as the soulcaster drew their hand from their pocket, revealing a set of gemstones bound into a fabrial. Dalinar didn't look away, despite how the light made his eyes water. He wished he'd taken a drink or two before coming. Was he really supposed to watch something like this while sober? The soulcaster touched Gavilar on the forehead, and the transformation happened instantly. One moment Gavilar was there, the next he had become a statue. The soulcaster slipped a glove onto their hand, while other Ardents hurried to remove the wires that had held Gavilar's body in position. They used levers to tip him carefully forward until he was standing, holding a sword with point toward the ground, his other hand outstretched. He stared toward eternity, crown on his head, the curls of his beard and hair preserved delicately in the stone. A powerful pose. The mortuary sculptors had done a fantastic job. The Ardents pushed him back into an alcove where he joined the lines of other monarchs, most of them high princes of the Colin princedom. He would be forever frozen here, the image of a perfect ruler in his prime. Nobody would think of him as he'd been that terrible night, broken from his fall, his grand dreams cut short by treason.
"I'll have vengeance, mother," Elokar whispered. "I'll have it."
The young king spun toward the gathered light eyes, standing before his father's outstretched stone hand.
"You've each come to me privately to give support. Well, I demand you swear it in public. Today, we make a pact to hunt those who did this. Today, Alethkar goes to war."
He was greeted by stunned silence.
"I swear it," Torol Sadius said. "I swear to bring vengeance to the traitorous Parshmen, your majesty. You can depend upon my sword."
Good, Dalinar thought, as others spoke up. This would hold them together. Even in death, Gavilar provided an excuse for unity. Unable to stand that stone visage any longer, Dalinar left, stumping into the corridor toward the palace proper. Other voices echoed after him as high princes swore. If Elokar was going to chase those Parshendi back toward the plains, he'd expect the Blackthorn's help. But Dalinar hadn't been that man for years. He patted his pocket, looking for his flask. Damnation. He pretended he was better these days, kept telling himself he was in the process of finding a way out of this mess, of returning to the man he'd once been. But that man had been a monster. Frightening that nobody had blamed him for the things he'd done. Nobody but Evie, who had seen what the killing would do to him. He closed his eyes, hearing her tears. "Father?" a voice said from behind. Dalinar forced himself to stand upright, turning as Adolin scrambled up to him.
"Are you well, father?" "Yes," Dalinar said. "I just need to be alone."
Adolin nodded. Almighty above, the boy had turned out well, through little effort of Dalinar's. Adolin was earnest, likable, and a master of the sword. He was truly capable in modern Alethi society, where how you moved among groups was even more important than strength of arm. Dalinar had always felt like a tree stump in those kinds of settings. Too big, too stupid.
"Go back," Dalinar said. "Swear for our house on this vengeance pact."
Adolin nodded, and Dalinar continued onward, fleeing those fires below. Gavilar's stare judging him, the cries of people dying in the rift. By the time he reached the steps, he was practically running. He climbed one level, then another. Sweating, frantic, he raced through ornate hallways, past carved walls, sedate woods, and accusatory mirrors. He reached his chambers and scrabbled in his pockets for the keys. He'd locked the place tight. No more would Gavilar sneak in to take his bottles. Bliss waited inside. No, not bliss. Oblivion. Good enough. His hands wouldn't stop shaking. He couldn't. It... "Follow the codes tonight." Dalinar's hands trembled and he dropped the keys. "There is something strange upon the winds. Screams for mercy.
Get out of my head. All of you, get out!"
In the distance, a voice. "You must find the most important words a man can say."
Which key was it?
He got one into the lock, but it wouldn't turn. He couldn't see. He blinked, feeling dizzy.
"Those words came to me from one who claimed to have seen the future," the voice said, echoing in the hallway.
Feminine. Familiar.
"How is this possible?" I asked in return. "Have you been touched by the void?" The reply was laughter. "No, sweet king. The past is the future, and as each man has lived, so must you. So I can but repeat what has been done before? In some things, yes. You will love, you will hurt, you will dream, and you will die. Each man's past is your future." "Then what is the point," I asked, "if all has been seen and done?" "The question," she replied,
is not whether you will love, hurt, dream, and die. It is what you will love, why you will hurt, when you will dream, and how you will die. This is your choice. You cannot pick the destination, only the path.
Dalinar dropped the keys again, sobbing. There was no escape. He would fall again. Wine would consume him like a fire consumed a corpse, leaving only ash. There was no way out.
"This started my journey," the voice said, "and this begins my writings. I cannot call this book a story, for it fails at its most fundamental to be a story. It is not one narrative, but many. And though it has a beginning, here on this page, my quest can never truly end. I wasn't seeking answers. I felt that I had those already. Plenty in multitude from a thousand different sources. I wasn't seeking myself. This is a platitude that people have ascribed to me, and I find the phrase lacks meaning. In truth, by leaving, I was seeking only one thing, a journey."
For years it seemed that Dalinar had been seeing everything around him through a haze. But those words, something about them, could words give off light? He turned from his door and walked down the corridor searching for the source of the voice. Inside the royal reading room he found Jasnah, with a huge tome set before her at a standing table. She read to herself, turning to the next page, scowling.
"What is that book?"
Dalinar asked. Jasnah started. She wiped her eyes, smearing the makeup, leaving her eyes clean but raw. Holes in a mask.
"This is where my father got that quote," she said. The one he wrote as he died.
Only a few knew of that.
What book is it? An old text, Jasnah said. Ancient, once well regarded. It's associated with the Lost Radiance, so nobody references it anymore. There has to be some secret here. A puzzle behind my father's last words? A cipher? But what?
Dalinar settled down into one of the seats. He felt as if he had no strength.
"Will you read it to me?"
Jasnah met his eyes, chewing her lip as she'd always done as a child. Then she read in a clear, strong voice, starting over from the first page, which he'd just heard. He had expected her to stop after a chapter or two, but she didn't, and he didn't want her to. Dalinar listened, rapt. People came to check on them. Some brought Jasnah water to drink. For once, he didn't ask them for anything. All he wanted was to listen. He understood the words, but at the same time he seemed to be missing what the book said. It was a sequence of vignettes about a king who left his palace to go on a pilgrimage. Dalinar couldn't define, even to himself, what he found so striking about the tales. Was it their optimism? Was it the talk of paths and choices? It was so unpretentious, so different from the boasts of society or the battlefield. Just a series of stories, their morals ambiguous. It took almost 8 hours to finish, but Jasnah never gave any indication she wanted to stop. When she read the last word, Dalinar found himself weeping again. Jasnah dabbed at her own eyes. She had always been so much stronger than he was, but here they shared an understanding. This was their sending off to Gavilar's soul. This was their farewell. Leaving the book on the lectern, Jasnah walked over to Dalinar as he stood up. They embraced, saying nothing. After a few moments, she left. He went to the book, touching it, feeling the lines of the writing stamped into its cover. He didn't know how long he'd been standing there when Adolin peeked in. "Father, we're planning to send expeditionary forces to the Shattered Plains. Your input would be appreciated."
"I must," Dalinar whispered, "go on a journey."
"Yeah," Adolin said. "It's a long way. Might get some hunts in while we're on our way, if there's time. Elikar wants these barbarians wiped out quickly. We could be gone and back in a year."
Paths. Dalinar could not choose his end, but perhaps his path.
"The old magic can change a person," Evie had said. "Make something great of them."
Dalinar stood up taller. He turned and stepped toward Adolin, seizing him by the shoulder.
"I've been a poor father these last few years," Dalinar said.
"Nonsense," Adolin said.
"I've been a poor father," Dalinar repeated, raising his finger. "To you and your brother both. You should know how proud I am of you."
Adolin beamed, glowing like a sphere right after a storm. Glory Spren sprang up around him.
"We will go to war together," Dalinar said, "like we did when you were young. I will show you what it is to be a man of honor. But first, I need to take an advance force without you, I'm afraid, and secure the Shattered Plains."
"We talked about that," Adolin said, eager. "Like your elites from before. Fast, quick. You'll march..."
"Sail," Dalinar said.
"Sail?"
"The rivers should be flowing," Dalinar said. "I'll march south, then take a ship to Dumadari. From there, I'll sail to the Ocean of Origins and make landfall at New Natanin. I'll move in toward the Shattered Plains with my force and secure the region, preparing for the rest of you to arrive."
"That would be a sound idea, I guess," Adolin said.
It was sound. Sound enough that when one of Dalinar's ships was delayed and Dalinar himself remained in port, sending most of his force on without him,
nobody would think it strange. Dalinar did get himself into trouble. He would swear his men and sailors to secrecy and travel a few months out of his way before continuing on to the Shattered Plains. Evie had said the old magic could transform a man. It was about time he started trusting her.
106. Law is Light.
"I find Ba-Edo Mishram to be the most interesting of the unmade. She is said to have been keen of mind, a high princess among the enemy forces, their commander during some of the desolations. I do not know how this relates to the ancient god of the enemy named Odium."
From Hesse's Mythica, page 224. Zeth of Shinovar flew with the Skybreakers for 3 days southward. They stopped several times to recover hidden stockpiles in mountain peaks or remote valleys. To find doorways, they often had to hack through 5 inches of creme. That amount of buildup had probably taken centuries to accumulate, yet Nin spoke of the places as if he'd just left. At one, he was surprised to find the food long since decayed, though fortunately the gemstone stockpile there had been hidden in a place where it remained exposed to the storms. In these visits, Zeth finally began to grasp how ancient this creature was. On the fourth day, they reached Marat. Zeth had been to the kingdom before. He had visited most of Roshar during the years of his exile. Historically, Marat wasn't truly a nation, but neither was it a place of nomads like the backwaters of Hexi or Tufalia. Instead, Marat was a group of loosely connected cities, tribally run, with a high prince at their head, though in the local dialect he was called Elder Brother. The country made for a convenient way stop between the Boren kingdoms of the east and the Makabaki ones of the center-west. Zeth knew that Marat was rich in culture, full of people as proud as you'd find in any nation, but of almost no value on the political scale, which made it curious that Nin chose to end their flight here. They landed on a plain full of strange brown grass that reminded Zeth of wheat, save for the fact that this pulled down into burrows, leaving visible only the small bob of grain on the top. This was casually eaten by wild beasts that were wide and flat, like walking discs, with claws only on the underside to shove the grain into their mouths. The disc-like animals would probably migrate eastward. Their droppings containing seeds that stuck to the ground would survive storms to grow into first-stage polyps. Those would later blow to the west and become second-stage grain. All life worked in concert, he'd been taught in his youth. Everything but men, who refused their place, who destroyed instead of added. Nin spoke briefly with Ki and the other masters, who took to the air again. The others joined them, all but Zeth and Nin himself, and streaked toward a town in the distance. Before Zeth could follow, Nin took him by the arm and shook his head. Together the two of them flew to a smaller town on a hill near the coast. Zeth knew the effects of war when he saw them. Broken doors, ruins of a short breached wall. The destruction looked recent, though any bodies had been cleaned out and the blood had been washed away by high storms. They landed before a large stone building with a peaked roof. Mighty doors of soul-cast bronze lay broken off in the rubble. Zeth would be surprised if somebody didn't return to claim those for their metal. Not every army had access to soul-casters.
"Aw," the sword said from his back. "We missed the fun."
"That tyrant in Tukar," Zeth said, looking through the silent town. "He decided to end his war against Imul and expand eastward?" "No," Nin said. "This is a different danger." He pointed toward the building with the broken doors. "Can you read that writing above the doorway, Zeth's son Naturo? It's in the local language. I don't know the script, Aboshi." The divine honorific was his best guess of how to address one of the heralds, though among his people it had been reserved for the great spren of the mountains. "It says justice," Nin said. "This was a courthouse." Zeth followed the herald up the steps and into the cavernous main room of the ruined courthouse. In here, sheltered from the storm, they found blood on the floor. No bodies, but plenty of discarded weapons, helms, and, disturbingly, the meager possessions of civilians. The people had likely taken refuge inside here during the battle, a last grasp at safety.
"The ones you call Parshmen name themselves the Singers," Nin said. "They took this town and pressed the survivors into labor at some docks farther along the coast." "Was what happened here justice, Zeth son Naturo?"
"How could it be?" He shivered. The dark reaches of the room seemed to be filled with haunted whispers. He drew closer to the herald for safety.
"Ordinary people? Living ordinary lives, suddenly attacked and murdered?" "A poor argument. But if the lord of this city had stopped paying his taxes, then forced his people to defend the city when higher authorities arrived and attacked, is not a prince justified in maintaining order in his lands? Sometimes it is just to kill ordinary people."
"But that did not happen here," Zeth said. "You said this was caused by an invading army."
"Yes," Nin said softly. "This is the fault of invaders. That is true."
He continued walking through the hollow room, Zeth staying close behind him.
"You are in a unique position, Zeth son Naturo. You will be the first to swear the oaths of a skybreaker in a new world, a world where I have failed."
They found steps near the back wall. Zeth got out a sphere for light, as Nin did not appear to be so inclined. That drove the whispers back.
"I visited Ishar," Nin continued. "You call him Ishu Sun God. He has always been the most wise of us. I did not want to believe what had happened."
Zeth nodded. He had seen that. After the first Everstorm, Nin had insisted that the Voidbringers hadn't returned. He had given excuse after excuse. until eventually he'd been forced to admit what he was seeing.
"I worked for thousands of years to prevent another desolation," Nin continued. "Ishar warned me of the danger. Now that Honor is dead, other Radiants might upset the balance of the Oath Pact, might undermine certain measures we took, and give an opening to the enemy."
He stopped at the top of the steps and looked down at his hand, where a glistening shard blade appeared, one of the two missing Honor blades. Zeth's people had care of 8. Once, long ago, it had been 9. Then this one had vanished. He'd seen depictions of it, strikingly straight and unornamented for a shard blade, yet still elegant. 2 slits ran the length of the weapon, gaps that could never exist in an ordinary sword as they would weaken it. They walked along a loft at the top of the courtroom. Records storage, judging by the scattered ledgers on the floor.
"You should draw me,"
the sword said.
"And do what, Sword Nimi?" Zeth whispered.
"Fight him. I think he might be evil."
"He is one of the Heralds, one of the least evil things in the world."
"Huh. Doesn't bode well for your world, then. Anyway, I'm better than that sword he has. I can show you."
Picking his way past the legal debris, Zeth joined Nin beside the loft's window. In the distance, farther along the coast, a large bay glistened with blue water. Many masts of ships gathered there, figures buzzing around them.
"I have failed," Nin repeated. "And now, for the people, justice must be done. A very difficult justice, Zeth son Naturo. Even for my skybreakers. We will endeavor to be as passionless and logical as you, Aboshi."
Nin laughed. It didn't seem to carry the mirth that it should have.
"Me? No, Zeth son Naturo. I am hardly passionless. This is the problem."
He paused, staring out the window at the distant ships.
"I am different from how I once was. Worse, perhaps. Despite all that, a part of me wishes to be merciful."
"And is mercy such a bad thing, Aboshi?"
"Not bad, merely chaotic. If you look through the records in this hall, you will find the same story told again and again. Leniency and mercy. Men set free despite crimes because they were good fathers, or well-liked in the community, or in the favor of someone important. Some of those who are set free change their lives and go on to produce for society. Others recidivate and create great tragedies. The thing is, Zeth son Naturo, we humans are terrible at spotting which will be which. The purpose of the law is so we do not have to choose, so our native sentimentality will not harm us."
He looked down again at his sword.
"You," he said to Zeth, "must choose a third ideal. Most skybreakers choose to swear themselves to the law, and follow with exactness the laws of whatever lands they visit. That is a good option, but not the only one. Think wisely and choose."
"Yes, Aboshi," Zeth said.
"There are things you must see and things you must know before you can speak. The others must interpret what they have sworn before, and I hope they will see the truth. You will be the first of a new order of skybreakers."
He looked back out the window.
"The singers allowed the people of this town to return here to burn their dead, a kinder gesture than most conquerors would allow."
"Aboshi, may I ask you a question?"
"Law is light, and darkness does not serve it. Ask, and I will answer."
"I know you are great, ancient, and wise," Zeth said, "but
to my lesser eyes. You do not seem to obey your own precepts. You hunted surge-binders, as you said.
I obtained legal permission for the executions I performed.
Yes, Zeth said.
But you ignored many lawbreakers to pursue these few. You had motives beyond the law, Aboshi. You were not impartial. You brutally enforced specific laws to achieve your ends.
This is true.
So is this just your own sentimentality?
In part,
though I have certain leniencies. The others have told you of the fifth ideal,
the ideal where the Skybreaker becomes the law.
Nin held out his empty left hand. A shard blade appeared there, different and distinct from the honor blade he carried in the other hand.
I am not only a herald, but a Skybreaker of the fifth ideal. Though I was originally skeptical of the Radiance, I believe I am the only one who eventually joined his own order.
And now, Zeth, son Naturo, I must tell you of the decision we heralds made long ago. On the day that would become known as Ahare Etiam, the day we sacrificed one of our own to end the cycle of pain and death.
107. The First Step. There is very little information about Ba Edo Mishram in more modern times. I can only assume she, unlike many of them, returned to damnation or was destroyed during Ahare Etiam. From Hesse's Mythica, page 226. Dalinar found a wash basin ready for him in the morning. Navani meticulously kept it filled, just as she cleaned up the bottles and allowed the servants to bring him more. She trusted him better than he trusted himself. Stretching in his bed, Dalinar woke feeling far too whole, considering the drinking he'd been doing. Indirect sunlight illuminated the room from the window. Normally they kept the shutters in this room closed to ward off the cold mountain air. Navani must have opened them after rising. Dalinar splashed his face with water from the basin, then caught a hint of his own scent.
Right.
He looked into one of the connecting rooms, which they'd appropriated for a washroom, as it had a back entrance the servants could use. Sure enough, Navani had ordered the tub filled for him. The water was cold, but he'd known his share of cold baths. It would keep him from lingering. A short time later, he took a razor to his face, peering at himself in a bedroom mirror. Gavilar had taught him to shave. Their father had been too busy getting himself cut apart in foolish duels of honor, including the one where he'd taken a blow to the head. He'd never been right after that. Beards were unfashionable in Alethkar these days, but that wasn't why Dalinar shaved. He liked the ritual. The chance to prepare, to cut away the nightly chaff and reveal the real person underneath, furrows, scars, and harsh features included. A clean uniform and underclothes waited for him on a bench. He dressed, then checked the uniform in the mirror, pulling down on the bottom of the coat to tighten any folds. That memory of Gavilar's funeral, so vivid. He'd forgotten parts. Had that been the Night Watcher or the natural course of memories? The more he recovered of what he had lost, the more he realized that the memories of men were flawed. He'd mention an event now fresh to his mind, and others who had lived it would argue over details as each recalled it differently. Most, Navani included, seemed to remember him as more noble than he deserved. Yet he didn't ascribe any magic to this. It was simply the way of human beings, subtly changing the past in their minds to match their current beliefs. But then, that vision with Noadon, where had that come from? Just a common dream? Hesitant, he reached out to the Stormfather, who rumbled distantly.
Still there, I see, Dalinar said, relieved. Where would I go? I hurt you, Dalinar said. When I activated the Oath Gate, I was afraid you would leave me. This is the lot I have chosen, It is you or oblivion. I'm sorry, regardless, for what I did. Were you involved in that dream I had? The one with Noadon?
I know of no such dream.
It was vivid, Dalinar said. More surreal than one of the visions, true, but captivating. What was the most important step a man could take? The first, obviously. But what did it mean? He still bore the weight of what he had done at the Rift. This recovery, this stepping away from the week spent drinking, wasn't a redemption. What would he do if he felt the thrill again? What would happen the next time the weeping in his mind became too difficult to bear? Dalinar didn't know. He felt better today, functional. For now, he would let that be enough. He picked a piece of lint off his collar, then belted on a side sword and stepped out of the bedroom, walking through his study and into the larger room with the hearth.
"Teravangian?" he said, surprised to find the elderly king seated there.
"Wasn't there to be a meeting of the monarchs today?" He vaguely remembered Navani telling him of it early that morning.
"He said I wasn't needed."
"Nonsense. We're all needed at the meetings." Dalinar paused.
"I've missed several, haven't I? Well, regardless, what are they talking about today?"
"Tactics."
Dalinar felt his face go red.
"The deployment of troops in the defense of Yarkaved, your kingdom?"
"I think they believe that I will give up the throne of Yarkaved once a suitable local man has been found."
He smiled.
"Do not be so outraged on my behalf, my friend. They didn't forbid me. They simply noted I wasn't needed. I wanted some time to think, so I came here."
"Still, let's go up, shall we?"
Teravangian nodded, standing. He wobbled on unsteady legs, and Dalinar hurried over to help him. Stabilized, Teravangian patted Dalinar's hand.
"Thank you. You know, I've always felt old, but lately it seems my body is determined to give me persistent reminders."
"Let me summon a palanquin to carry you."
"No, please. If I give up walking, I fear my deterioration will increase. I've seen similar things happen to people in my hospitals."
But he held Dalinar's arm as they walked toward the doorway. Outside, Dalinar collected some guards of his own, along with Teravangian's large Thalen bodyguard. They started toward the lifts.
"Do you know," Dalinar said, "if there's word?"
"From Kolinar?"
Teravangian asked. Dalinar nodded. He vaguely remembered updates from Navani. No news of Adolin, Elokar, or the Radiance. But had he been of sound enough mind to listen?
"I'm sorry, Dalinar,"
Teravangian said.
"So far as I know, we haven't had a message from them. But we must keep hope, of course. They might have lost their span reed or gotten trapped in the city."
"I may have felt something," the Stormfather said. "During a recent high storm, it felt like Stormblessed was there with me. I do not know what it means, for I cannot see him or the others anywhere. I presumed them dead, but now I find myself believing." "Why?"
"You have hope,"
Dalinar whispered, smiling.
"Dalinar?"
Teravangian asked.
"Just whispering to myself, Your Majesty."
"If I might say, you seem stronger today. You've decided something?"
"More. I've remembered something."
"Is it something you can share with a worried old man?"
"Not yet. I'll try to explain once I have it figured out myself."
After an extended trip up the lifts, Dalinar led Teravangian into a quiet, windowless chamber on the penultimate floor of the tower. They dubbed it the Gallery of Maps, after a similar location in the war camps. Aladar led the meeting, standing beside a table that was covered by a large map of Alethkar and Yarkaved.
The dark-skinned Alethi man wore his war uniform, the mix of a traditional Takama shirt and modern jacket that had been catching on among his officers. His bodyguard, Mintez, stood behind him in full shard plate. Aladar preferred not to use the shards personally. He was a general, not a warrior. He nodded to Dalinar and Taravangian when they entered. Iole sat nearby and studied Dalinar, saying nothing. He'd almost have welcomed a wisecrack. In the old days, she'd been quick to joke with him. Her silence now didn't mean she was being respectful. It meant she was saving her barbs to whisper where he couldn't hear. High Prince Ruthar, thick-armed and wearing a full beard, sat with Iole. He'd opposed Dalinar from the start. The other Alethi High Prince who had come today was Hatham, a long-necked man with light orange eyes. He wore a red and gold uniform of a type that Dalinar hadn't seen before, with a short jacket that buttoned only at the top. Silly-looking, but what did Dalinar know of fashion? The man was extremely polite, and he ran a tight army. Queen Fenn had brought the Thalen High Admiral, a scrawny old man with mustaches that drooped almost to the table. He wore a short sailor's saber and sash, and looked like exactly the type who would complain about being stuck on the land for too long. She'd also brought her son, the one Dalinar had dueled, who saluted Dalinar sharply. Dalinar saluted back. That boy would make an excellent officer, if he could learn to keep his temper. The Azish Emperor wasn't there, nor was their little edge dancer. Instead, Azir had sent a collection of scholars. Azish generals tended to be of the armchair type, military historians and theorists who spent their days in books. Dalinar was certain they had men with practical knowledge in their military, but those rarely ended up promoted. So long as you failed certain tests, you could remain in the field and command. Dalinar had met the two Vaden High Princes during his trip to their city. The brothers were tall, prim men with short black hair and uniforms much like those of the Alethi. Taravangian had appointed them after their predecessors had been poisoned following the civil war. Yakaved obviously still had many problems.
"Dalinar?" Aladar said. He stood up straighter, then saluted. "Right, Lord. You're looking better."
Storms, how much did the rest of them know?
"I've spent some time in meditation," Dalinar said. "I see you've been busy. Tell me about the defensive array."
"Well," Aladar said, "we..."
"That's it," Queen Fenn interrupted. "What in damnation was wrong with you? You ran all around Vedinar like a wild man, then locked yourself in your room for a week."
"I was excommunicated from the Boren Church soon after hearing of Kolinar's fall. I took it poorly. Did you expect me to react by throwing a feast?"
"I expected you to lead us, not sulk."
"I deserved that." "You are right. You can't have a commander who refuses to command. I'm sorry."
The Azish whispered among themselves, looking surprised at the bluntness of the exchange. But Fenn settled back, and Aladar nodded. Dalinar's mistakes had needed to be aired. Aladar began explaining their battle preparations. The Azish generals, all wearing robes and western hats, crowded around, offering commentary through translators. Dalinar used a little stormlight and touched one on the arm to gain access to their language for a short time. He found their advice surprisingly astute, considering that they were basically a committee of scribes. They'd moved 10 battalions of Alethi troops through the Oath Gates, along with 5 battalions of Azish. That put 15,000 men on the ground in Yakaved, including some of their most loyal Kolin and Aladar forces. That seriously cut into his troop numbers. Storms, they'd lost so many at Narak. The companies that Dalinar had remaining at Urethiru were mostly recruits or men from other princedoms who had asked to join his military. Sabario, for example, had cut back to maintaining only a single division, giving Dalinar the rest to wear Kolin colors. Dalinar had interrupted a discussion of how to fortify the Yakaved border. He offered some insights, but mostly listened as they explained their plans. Stockpiles here, garrisons there. They hoped the Windrunners would be able to scout for them. Dalinar nodded, but found that something bothered him about this battle plan. A problem he couldn't define. They'd done well, their lines of supply had been drawn realistically, and their scout posts were spaced for excellent coverage. What then was wrong? The door opened, revealing Navani, who froze when she saw Dalinar, then melted into a relieved smile. He nodded to her as one of the Vaden High Princes explained why they shouldn't abandon the backwater strip of land running east of the Horneater Peaks. Aladar had been ready to cede it and use the peaks as a barrier.
"It's not only about the opportunity to levy troops from His Majesty's Horneater subjects, Bright Lord," the High Prince, Non-Urian, explained Inaleti. "These lands are lush and well-appointed, buffered from storms by the very Aleti Highlands you've been speaking of. We've always fought desperately for them against invasions because they will succor those who seize them and provide staging areas for assaults on the rest of Yakoved."
Dalinar grunted. Navani stepped over to where most of them stood around the table map, so he reached out and put his arm around her waist.
"He's right, Aladar. I spent a long time skirmishing on that very border. That area is more important strategically than it first appears."
"Holding it is going to be tough," Aladar said. "We'll get mired in an extended battle for that ground."
"Which is what we want, isn't it?" the Vaden High Prince said. "The longer we stall the invasion, the more time it will give my Vaden brethren to recover." "Yes," Dalinar said. "Yes."
It was easy to get mired in battles along the vast Vaden front. How many years had he spent fighting false bandits there?
"Let's take a break. I want to consider this."
The others seemed to welcome the opportunity. Many stepped into the larger chamber outside, where attendants with span reeds waited to relay information. Navani stayed beside Dalinar as he surveyed the map.
"It's good to see you up," she whispered.
"You're more patient than I deserve. You should have dumped me out of bed and poured the wine on my head."
"I had a feeling you'd push through."
"I have for now," he said. "In the past, a few days or even weeks of sobriety didn't mean much."
"You're not the man you were back then."
"Oh, Navani, I never grew beyond that man. I just hid him away."
He couldn't explain that to her yet. Instead, he whispered thanks into her ear and rested his hand on hers. How could he ever have been frustrated at her advances? For now, he turned his attention to the maps and lost himself in them. The fortresses, the storm bunkers, the cities, the drawn-in supply lines.
"What's wrong?" Dalinar thought. "What am I not seeing? 10 silver kingdoms, 10 oath gates, the keys to this war. Even if the enemy can't use them, they can hinder us by seizing them. One in Alethkar, which they already have, one in Natanatan, the Shattered Plains, which we have, one in Vaidenar, one in Azimir, one in Thalen City, all 3 hours, but one in Ral Elorim and one in Kurth, both the enemies by now, one in Shinovar, belonging to neither side. That left the one in Penatham, in Babatharnam, which the combined Iriale and Riran armies might have captured already, and one in Akana, which Yasna was confident had been destroyed long ago. Yakoved made the most sense for the enemy to attack, didn't it? Only, once you engaged yourself in Yakoved, you were stuck fighting a long war of attrition. You lost mobility, had to dedicate enormous resources to it. He shook his head, feeling frustrated. He left the map, trailed by Navani, and stepped into the other room for refreshment. At the wine table, he forced himself to pour a warm, spiced orange. Something with no kick. Yasna joined the group, delivering a stack of papers to her mother.
"May I see?"
Ile asked.
"No,"
Yasna replied. Dalinar hid a smile in his drink.
"What secrets are you keeping?" Ile asked. "What happened to your uncle's grand talk of unification?"
"I suspect that each monarch in this room," Yasna said, "would prefer to know that state secrets are allowed to remain their own. This is an alliance,
not a wedding. Queen Fen nodded at that. As for these papers, Jasna continued, they happen to be a scholarly report which my mother has not yet reviewed. We will release what we discover once we are certain that our translations are correct and that nothing in these notes might give our enemies an advantage against this city. Jasna cocked an eyebrow. Or would you prefer our scholarship be sloppy? The Azish seemed mollified by this.
I just think, Ile said, you showing up here with them is a slap in the face for the rest of us.
Ile, Jasna said, it is good you are here. Sometimes an intelligent, dissenting voice tests and proves a theory. I do wish you'd work harder on the intelligent part.
Dalinar downed the rest of his drink and smiled as Ile settled back in her chair, wisely not escalating a verbal battle against Jasna. Unfortunately, Ruthar did not have similar sense.
Don't mind her, Ile, he said, mustache wet with wine. The godless have no concept.